The new world order really consists of three aspects. There is a new world political system that everyone today is calling the new world order. As well as that, there is an economic plan for the new world order, and that is called the new world economic order. In addition to those two items, there's a third plan for religion. You see, the planners of the world know that men need a religion of some kind, even if it's a false one. So they have a plan to give us a new age world global occultic religion. So really there's three aspects to this new world order. A new world economic order in which a computer chip will be injected into our hands or foreheads as a means to track, control, and identify us, and will also be used to make our purchases and scan
it. Well, they've already put the program in Los Angeles. In fact, a trilateralist named Mayor Bradley, Uncle Tom Bradley, was responsible for putting this in dogs.
Right.
And your children will be considered like animals. And
operating through the Council on Foreign Relations, through the Trilateral Commission, through the Club of Rome, through Global 2000, which wants to reduce the population of the planet by, 25%. That's 1,250,000,000 people have to be exterminated by the year 2000.
Well, they can do that.
So
they
essentially, this Illuminati then is the group of men who control not only all the money on the planet through all the world banks and the Federal Reserve and so on, but they control essentially all the governments. And so these men are planning to bring about a global form of government that's unique in all history. It's a total enslaving system of world communism and fascism, controlled by a hierarchy in Europe that Anthony calls what? The oligarchy.
Well, no, I call it the evilarchy.
The evilarchy.
The oligarchy of evil.
So these men are satanically inspired, and of course we get that term from the Bible, which means the devil. They're satanically inspired to bring about a global form of government to every nation on earth.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 29th of November 2024, streaming live from Eastone Studios in Bristol. We are live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, not actually on Talk Radio, which is a Murdoch channel. As someone was saying, that they've been telling people today that we're on Talk Radio. Well, actually, we are. We're on the real Talk Radio, which is a internet stream called talkradio.org.uk, not the Murdoch pro-Israeli genocide propaganda outfit. And so we're on there, and we're also on RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. We're at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from APK Pure or Apple. Also, not Google Play, possibly not Aurora either anymore. But the best way to get a hold of the app is simply go to thisweek.org.uk, scroll down, and you will find a page with all the Apple and the Android versions of the app. Well worth having, and it works. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade zero-trust agenda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators, and hatchet jobs on the heroes, with a little bit of truth manages to get in occasionally. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against World War III and wage slavery. So for those with eyes to see and ears to hear, those with so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, climate, housing, a new one every few months, twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies crafted to make every crisis worse. So if you don't know anything about Armageddonism, that's actually David Halpin's expression, accelerationism, do look it up. Get to grips with this little concept. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Weft King Tampon Charlie and vampire queen Carmilla are waging war on the British people, as well as on China, Russia, and the BRICS. So, helping us navigate this week's accelerationist WEF agenda is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also joining us in the studio is local freelance journalist Joe banks. So we'll be looking as well at local planning and development at Bristol City Council and the composition of the council, how it's made up and why. We'll be looking at the farmers, also looking at the defence cuts in part two, but more importantly, a million leaving Israel, and also MI5 being proved to be above the law in Manchester Arena, as well as becoming quite regular now, these anonymous reports from Gaza itself. So Iranian and Russian news censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom, and us cancelled off good old Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, and from People's Republic of Stokes Croft by the trans lobby. But not cancelled off of here yet. I suppose I should start really by introducing you, Joe. You've come along, I know, to talk about some of the new regime we've got here in Bristol. Now, the context of it, it's been a Labour city, as most cities are, for many years, with the countryside being Tory. But there's been a bit of disillusion with the Labour Party, particularly under Starmer. And so at the local elections back in May, we had the city's first ever green administration.
Well, a kind of green administration, but what also came in at the same time was a new committee system, which a new way of running the council. So previously we had this mayoral system that would have the 12 years, 4 years of George Ferguson, 8 years of Marvin Rees. And then the city decided in a referendum to scrap the mayoral system and bring in not a cabinet and leader system, which a lot of councils have, but a committee system, which means that the council's run by nine policy committees.
But hang on, we've got a leader. His name is Tony Dyer. He's a Green councillor, but you're saying we don't have a leader system, but we've got one anyway.
Well, it's confusing. And so you've got a leader position who is a Green, who's the most, you know, prominent councillor in the city. But because the Greens didn't get a majority of seats on the council, they can't be said to be an administration or running.
Right.
Because these policy committees, have a cross party and have a spread based on the number of seats.
So they're the largest single party, but they don't have a majority.
Yes. And so they don't, crucially, it means the Greens can say, we're not running this council. You know, we're all in it together.
Right.
Sort of is the mantra. But it's now quite hard to see where accountability lies.
Everyone is passing the buck. That's what it sounds like to me. Martin, I know, you went with, when this first happened back in May, you pointed out the Greens had a go at running Brighton. They didn't last long, did they?
Well, I think that actually running things in a situation like this, where the budgets are completely ripped to shreds over many years, you can't imagine that they're going to be able to do, they're going to face exactly the same constraints as any administration.
Yeah, but surely the thing is with the electorate is if you're fessing all this up to the electorate and you're showing that you're doing your best you can with the lack of resources that you've got and you're prioritising the spending in the right way, then you will get re-elected even if you've got less money to spend.
Well, that's what it boils down to. But I think people still have this expectation that councils have got lots of powers. And of course they haven't really. I mean, the budgets are all messed up by things like special needs provision, which is not, accounted for. So they have to find it, the money from behind the back of the sofa. And of course, a new system, any new system, is going to take time to bed in, even if it's going to work.
Well, one of the most important things Bristol City Council does is house people. We've still got a lot of Bristol City Council housing. Joe, I know the regulators have been having a little look at Bristol City Council. This is a government regulator, because a lot of public money does go into supporting housing associations, and so they quite rightly expect that it's being spent wisely.
Yeah, this is probably the major issue that the new administration, if there is an administration, Bristol City Council is having to deal with, is basically the crisis that's been revealed in social housing in the city, and this has been revealed through something that actually the one of the few decent things that the Tories did was bring legislation that became law in 2023, which was the Social Housing Regulation Act, which was brought through by Michael Gove predominantly. But this was their response to Grenfell and to there was a high-profile death of a two-year-old boy in Rochdale as a result of prolonged exposure to mould. And so this act gave increased powers to the regulator of social housing. And since April, they've been grading councils on the state of their social housing as landlords, and give them Bristol City Council a C3 grade, which is the one off the worst, one away from the worst.
You know, by some mad coincidence, I was sitting down chatting to four of the social housing regulators yesterday to do with another housing association. So they're going round, and the chap was telling me, well, we've only done a few of these proper I think they call them inspections, where they go in, have a good old look, see what's going on, and then they rate it, and that they stand a chance of having their accreditation as a social housing taken away from them if the council have done it wrong. So, Martin, if I can turn to you, because most of this sort of thing that Joe's talking about here, surely this is something which we associate with private landlords, with the sharks out there who are just trying to squeeze as much as they can from their tenants, and they don't really care if the roof caves in.
Yeah, but social land, I mean, council housing is one thing. The councils are directly responsible for it. And in Bristol, we still have quite a bit of council housing, which is quite rare, actually. But social housing, it's social, you know, as you know, it's housing associations. And, they're increasingly, you know, driven by profit. You know, they are supposedly independent, and they don't actually function within any kind of plan. And, you know, they're completely
different to private landlords, housing associations, because, yeah.
But just to clarify, this regulator of social housing is looking at council housing and housing associations.
Yeah.
And you know, and the things they found at Bristol City Council, you know, were really shocking. It was, you know, stuff like the council couldn't evidence that it was meeting carbon monoxide safety requirements for over 22,000 homes, over 3,000 damp and mould cases, 16,000 overdue repairs, over 50% of its properties it was unable to evidence a current electrical safety certificate, you know, and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And crucially, just they didn't know what was a complete lack of data. You know, they didn't know what was going on.
This sounds to me as if previous administrations are probably responsible for this, Joe, that they've been kicking the can down the road thinking, oh, well, you know, OK, we don't have all the right legal documentation for all this, but it's better that someone's got somewhere to live than that we've got all the right paperwork saying it's safe.
Yeah. Well, it's good. You know, as Martin's saying, obviously a big factor in this is the huge reduction in funding that's gone to councils. But I think there are also questions about, you know, the priorities of that mayoral regime under Marvin Rees, who did make housing, you know, the centrepiece of his policy agenda. But, you know, what this has all revealed is that it was a complete shambles in that housing department. And really the focus was on building new housing, you know, and you know, a huge amount of that that's being built in Bristol is not affordable.
But it's fair to say, isn't it, that Paul Smith, Martin, who was had that housing portfolio a couple of years before the end of the Marvin regime, actually stepped away from the job, didn't he? I think he knew there were serious problems that weren't being addressed. I remember him telling me privately that, and probably I shouldn't share this, but he said privately that both the mayor and the senior officer in charge of housing were ignoring him. And of course, when there's any sort of doubt about what's going to happen or not, the mayor could trump everything he said. So he didn't actually feel he was able to do his job, so he walked away.
Well, I mean, he'll have to speak for himself. I don't know what, you know, as you say, these are private conversations between you and him. I think that the emphasis in the Marvin regime, if we can call it that, was building new housing. That was what, you know, we're going to build houses and that's going to solve the problem, which of course is wrong-headed in the first place, because the kind of houses that get built don't solve the housing crisis at all.
I mean, if they're actually for wealthy people
who've got money to buy them.
If these houses or flats have been sold to the people who own them, maybe they would have been able to, or they would have more of an incentive to look after them and deal with these damp problems themselves.
Well, yes, but of course then, you know, what happened with the housing stock when it was all sold off? I mean, council housing is still, you know, they build new council houses now in this country, and there's the Labour government are thinking of making new housing that they build not cannot be sold off to the tenants. The policy of selling council housing less than it was worth to the existing tenants who'd got a big, you know, that was good for those people. But of course, we're now decades down the line since that policy was instituted.
Well, I mean, you're all saying,
and we can see the people sleeping in the streets as a result.
If the landlord isn't looking after the place, whether it's a tower block or a house, surely it's better that the place is sold off so the people who live there look after it themselves.
Well, yes, but you can't. What if the people in there haven't got the money to buy the house? Do you give it to them? You could. You could say privately rented people, maybe they should have the right to have their own homes.
Well,
they could just be confiscated from my landlord. Sorry, I live there. You give it to me.
Well, you might even find that some of the landlords are not able to make much money anymore doing private rented, so they might be happy to sell.
Well, I think what will happen when the housing market goes sour, as it will, people in private rented accommodation like me, as happened during the 2008 crisis, we're all going to be booted out. So there'll be a massive increase in people, and you won't be able to get anywhere else to live either.
I was having a bit of a joke with some friends this week about the new so-called affordable housing you're seeing springing up all across the country, where quite a lot of it seems to be detached, but only about a 6-inch or foot gap between the various different detached houses, which of course is not very good for retaining the heat. If in the old-fashioned terrace style, those houses were helping each other keep the heat in, and of course the reason that they build these silly detached houses with no front garden, hardly any back garden at all, just a little sort of yard, the heat is all leaching out through these houses, but they cost more to buy, so there's more profit in them. So the point I'm trying to make, Joe, here is actually the thing is the space and the quality of the build of a lot of old council housing is better than the modern affordable housing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is an issue that a lot of, you know, because there wasn't the building of new council housing, you know, basically stopped under Thatcher and never picked up. You know, the New Labour didn't do anything really about it either. The councils, you know, part of this problem is that councils have a lot of old, you know, aging housing that they're having to maintain, and haven't, you know, the problem is kind of, you know, as is being revealed at Bristol City Council, the problem just hasn't been grappled with. It's been swept under the carpet.
Well, in the 1950s, we had a massive house-building programme, and very little talk of starting any new wars, apart from maybe the Americans in Korea. Martin, it all seems to have gone upside down. Now the priority seems to be fighting the Russians and feeding the meat grinder in Ukraine, and billions are going into that, but virtually nothing into housing our people.
Well, that's right, and potholes in the road and no dentistry and all the rest of it. Yanis Varoufakis wrote an article in The Guardian last week pointing out that what's happened in Greece is that people who are owner-occupiers have gone bankrupt. They can't no longer keep up the mortgage, and it's all been bought up by German companies.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, they're now evicting people and so on. So
it's the financial sector that are buying.
Yes, that's right. So, in other words, what used to be, you know, he's saying, he was talking to the Germans, said, well, how are you going to get your money back? You're never going to get your money back. You know, they can't pay. So, well, what we're going to do is we're going to take over the housing stock, which is what they've done.
Well,
so
yeah.
These outside companies, outside Greece, have basically, you know, ended up in controlling the housing stock.
Well, I don't know if they really need to get their money back. The point is that these big financial organisations have got such a strong lobby, they're paying so little tax a lot of the time, that they're just looking for anything that's bricks and mortar to put that money into, rather than leaving it in a bank or stock exchange.
What they did with Greece is they got them into debt, and then once you're in debt, you never pay it back. It just means that you've got to give us your assets. This is what happens all over the world.
Is it a bit like the national debt here in British government in $3 trillion debt now?
Yes, well, I mean, people focus on that. That is not really... The real issue is the debt of the private sector and the banks, which was bailed out in 2008.
It's an important factor, isn't it? There's a lot of effort now going... where people are paying their taxes, much of it is now going just into debt repayment. It's not going into anything.
Well, that's right, because the whole system is based upon the government borrowing money from the private sector and then spending it, which can work. But on the other hand, why the government ought to actually print the money itself and not borrow... You don't have to borrow any money from anything.
It seems a bit funny,
isn't
it?
Of course, you could also just refuse to pay your debts. That's what developing countries are going to have to do. They cannot pay their dollar debts. They're just going to have to default, which then means, of course, a banking crisis in the north.
Right. So, Joe, what's Bristol City Council doing now they've been told you're rubbish when it comes to housing and you've got to sort it out?
Well, yeah, I mean, one thing to say is that I think it seems quite clear that it was kept quiet. You know, they were aware that this was... They were aware that they had a... Basically, they were going to be majorly not complying with the law early this year. But it was kind of kept quiet until the elections in May. Knowing that this legislation was going to come into effect with the regulator of social housing in April, they commissioned Savills to do a report on their housing back in November last year. They got news back basically in February this year that you know what a very bad picture it was, and they quietly officers quietly set up a program and a board of senior officers in the council to oversee how they were going to get to grips with this issue.
So this is all before the election.
This was before the election, but but none of this came out. The sort of the crucial thing is that when the council sets up a big program like this, which is going to have major cost implications, they're supposed to take that to what in the system that it was then was cabinet, or now it would be to a policy committee and get that voted through by elected representatives. But they didn't do that. They just kept it quiet, set it up internally within the council. Then in April, they self-referred themselves to the regulator saying, you know, we know things are terrible, so we're referring ourselves to you. But none of this really became public until July, you know, 3 months after the elections, when it came to the new housing committee. So, you know, they've got a huge work. Well, I mean, another thing... there's an irony here you might appreciate, is that they got a guy called Michael Reacher to come and do an external review of their sort of governance structure
or lack of
in the council, but this bloke was had been the housing boss at Southwark Council, he submitted his report last month. But just this week, and he left. So he was a housing boss at Southwark until last year, and he'd been there for 5.5 years. And just this week, the regulator has given Southwark the same C3 rating for serious failings in their housing.
So what did Bristol get? D plus minor.
C3. So okay. So basically, it's, you know, C1 is top mark. C2. You're a bit dodgy. C3 is serious failings. C4 is basically the government. If you don't do something immediately, the government's going to take you over.
So this is a bit more than just a shot across the bows, isn't it?
It's serious. It's really, really bad. It's crazy that the guy they've got in to tell them what to do about it, you know, has been overseeing, you know, exactly the same issues.
So what, with austerity, Martin, which started in the sort of 2011 really, under the coalition government, the councils around the country, they were quite sensibly saying, look, I mean, they're just pulling the rug out from underneath us. We need to make a list of all of the things we need to do by law, do those. And if we can't afford to do those, we will go cap in hand to the government and ask for money, or we will just literally throw in the towel and say, right, well, we haven't got enough, you're not giving us enough money to do what we're legally obliged to do, so you run the city, see if you can run it, the people with the money who are taking the money away from us. So this is quite, it's quite clear from what Joe's saying here, from this report, that Bristol City Council hasn't done that. There's a whole list of legal requirements here to do with fire safety, etc., damp and mold, this kind of thing, that they've just gone, well, shrugged their shoulders and gone, well, we're going to go do a TED talk or something instead, and we don't see this as a priority.
Well, obviously I don't know the detail in the way that Joe's done the research here. I mean, obviously there are two things going on. One is the, you know, competence or incompetence of Bristol City Council and its officers, and then the other thing is the underlying austerity agenda.
Well, there's another thing, isn't there, which is accountability. What they're doing is, when they know that they've broken the law, what they're doing is, rather than letting the voting public know that, they're keeping it all under wraps. They're going to commission Savills and some wonk from Southwark to go and do a nice, tidy, quiet report, which is going to take months and months to ever be made public. They're keeping it under their hat. And this is not what local authorities are there for. They're there to manage the city on behalf of us.
Yes, but I mean, as Joe's pointed out, they kept it quiet because there was an election coming up, and it would have been very bad for them electorally if all of this stuff had come out before the election.
Yes.
So obviously what they do at that point is they're doing damage limitation, aren't they?
Well, it's also, you could consider it to be misfeasance or malfeasance, deliberately withholding information that actually the public need to know. And should, you know, it's quite obvious that other councillors needed to know this. In order to manage the problem, the best thing to do is it's not just the best thing to do, it's the right thing to do, it's most probably the legal thing to do, is to make sure everyone knows that there is a problem. Otherwise, I honestly think misconduct in public office or of one sort or another, that's what this is. This should have been made public and it was kept quiet.
Well, it's not just in Bristol that these issues have arisen. They've also arisen in Southwark, as Joe has mentioned, and of course Birmingham City Council is bankrupt. Liverpool City Council is under special measures, so it doesn't matter who you vote for.
I think what I'm suggesting,
central government is running the
Martin, finances. I mean, it certainly seems particularly bad here. What I'm suggesting is, it's a different culture and a different mentality. You've worked in both the public sector and the private sector, mainly public sector, but you know there's a different culture in both. One of them is, you're a public servant, you're doing stuff for the public, and you're not looking just to make a profit and to save your reputation. In the private sector, that is exactly what you're doing, making money, and you're trying to preserve your brand. And it seems to me we've got a private business mentality which is running Bristol City Council as if it's a sausage factory.
Well, I mean, obviously there are issues there in Bristol, I think, but what Marvin would say, when he first got elected, we had a massive demonstration. He went down to London, and the same with all the other core cities, to say, look, you've got to give us some more money. Because, of course, the local authorities have always been the Cinderella. Because even when Thatcher came to power, she took local authorities' money away, she took away their powers to do things. And, of course, that creates a dilemma for opposition parties. So they get elected to the local council in Liverpool, for example, and they try and pursue a policy which is different than the central government. It ends up with the whole council being collapsed. Derek Hatton is turned into persona non grata, and ultimately that kind of confrontational approach with the government didn't work, because they were hoping there was going to be a massive uprising and people were going to stand up and defend local councils. Didn't happen. And so you then got a situation where local councils are trying to make the best of a bad job. And they don't, you know, the central government is quite happy for the Labour Party to deal with this mess in the major core cities, because it's all their fault. Now, I'm not saying that it isn't, some of it isn't their fault, there's obviously issues there, but ultimately underlying all of this is that things like national health, defence, education, there's a limit to how much money you can cut from that sort of stuff. But local authorities, they've been the whipping boys all along. And of course, you've now got a complete disjunction between what people expect a local authority to be able to do and what they can actually do. I mentioned earlier the special needs budget. Special needs budget has gone out of control virtually everywhere, because there's more and more special needs. People are getting legal documents which say that they're entitled to special needs funding, but the local authorities haven't got a budget for it. So every kid that they pay to get special needs support, like I work in this area, is money that they've got to find from somewhere else in the budget. And of course, none of this, the central government doesn't care about any of this, because when the Tories were in power, local government making a mess of everything and say, well, this is a terrible Labour Party, look what happens when you put them in power. And of course, what you could do is just refuse to participate in the elections and refuse to put in popular council in the 19th century. They just refused to set a rate and they all went to prison. Because you said we can't balance the books here, we're not even going to try. And there was, of course, that was against their fiduciary duty, so they were all sent to prison. And it then turned into a cause célèbre and so on.
So, Joe, do you think this is going to sort of be the legacy of Marvin Rees?
Well, I was going to just say...
He talked a lot about housing when he got in. Was saying, we're going to be building housing. What he didn't say is the existing stock is going to be run down.
Yeah, no, I think, council, there are perhaps 60, I think 27,000 council properties in Bristol, something like 60,000 tenants. And I think they can feel very, very let down. But I was going to mention that there was something that illustrates this sort of dynamic that's going on here is that last month, Marvin Rees accepted an award from the World Economic Forum for this the City Leap initiative that he set up, and that's what he trumpets as his great achievement in office. And what that did basically was basically create a contractual arrangement with a huge American multinational firm, Ameresco, to have complete oversight of all the energy efficiency works that were going to go on to all the council properties. So that means doing works to council blocks, replacing windows and putting on external insulation, saving. Reducing carbon emissions ultimately. So this is lauded by that sort of group of people that I think whose esteem was very important to Marvin Rees, and possibly more important than the esteem of the council residents he was supposed to be working for.
Martin, isn't it interesting, you're talking about in Germany these properties being bought up by the World Economic Forum. They're giving Martin a big pack on the back for his housing policy. Actually, what's been going on is people are now in the, or even the council might be in the situation where it says we're going to sell up this council housing because we can't manage it, but we know a financial institution that can.
Well, it's the public-private partnership nonsense, isn't it? That's what it is. I mean, back in the day when I were a lad, councils ran council housing. They had an in-house staff to do it all. They knew what they were doing. The buildings, they knew the buildings inside out because they'd built them. But now, because we've got to make this idea of carbon transition. I mean, obviously, Marvin, he's now at the university, is he not? He's got some kind of professorship in...
Oh, we could go into that.
Yeah. Yes, well, that's because it looks to me as if they made that job up for him because he didn't want to leave Bristol. And, of course, he's got influence in the university.
It was a reward. He
was tipped to work for the UN, wasn't he?
I did know Marvin Rees reasonably well back in the day, and I think one of the things that motivated him is he wanted to be, because he's a Bristol boy, born and bred and all the rest of it. So that's part of his brand. So he had the opportunity to go and perhaps become a Labour MP elsewhere in the country, but he didn't take it.
No, he didn't. It's not that he didn't take it. He was refused it.
Well, no, he tried to become the North.
The Labour Party didn't want him. They picked someone else.
That's right. But that was in a Bristol constituency. What I'm saying is he could have gone somewhere else completely, but he didn't, because that's not his mentality. He sees that as part of his brand. So he's now at Bristol University, but he sees himself as carrying on his pioneering work in saving the planet from climate change.
And of course, saving cities from climate change.
Well, that's right, but I mean, as you say, he's not fixing people's boilers and windows. That's a bit boring.
And really, the lights are going out. The street lights are going out. Meanwhile, and this sort of thing. Yeah, do you want to say something, Joe, about Marvin's role at the university? Because the university is a very big player in the city, isn't it? Some would say probably the biggest players in terms of development, planning and development, and the actual amount of money they're investing right now.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, they completely trumped the, if I can use, you can't really use that word anymore, but they took over the big slice of land next to Bristol Temple Meads Station that was going to be an arena. It seems the bigger players in a city that managed to grab that bit of land for themselves were the university. They're very big players.
And he was absolutely, obviously Marvin Rees ultimately made that decision about where the arena was going to go. And it was clearly, the university wanted, so this is the Temple Quarter regeneration area, which is one of the biggest regeneration projects in Europe at the moment. And the university wanted to build what they call an enterprise campus, didn't want to have an arena. The long established plans to have this arena built on land that would have been next door to that.
Yeah,
clearly they didn't want that to happen. And Marvin Rees made it work out that a Malaysian infrastructure development company who were building this major residential project on the outskirts of Bristol, right in the far north near the M5, that they could build the arena there instead, and that the university would have that area right by Temple Meads Station to build their enterprise campus, and have facilities that they wanted around it, like student accommodation and a conference centre and this kind of stuff.
Of course, the land is much more valuable, that land right next to Temple Meads, than up at Filton Airfield. That's a far more valuable land.
But and the major development going on in Bristol in recent years has been purpose-built student accommodation that's sprouting up everywhere. You know, they're now demolishing what was a Premier Inn hotel to build what's going to be the tallest building in Bristol ever, and that is student accommodation. So you've had this very clear relationship between the university, the developers who love purpose-built student accommodation because it's just gives you the best returns you can get. You know, it's an asset class that's not the same as normal residential, much smaller space standards and lower standards generally, and so that relationship between the university, those developers, and the mayor, were very strong, and it seems to me quite clear that he immediately got rewarded with a job from the university for what he'd done for them.
Well, yeah, yes, rather nice. I drive past Filton quite a bit. I look over there from time to time to see if there's any start on the arena that's supposed to be being built.
No,
Filton.
They haven't started yet. No.
So 8 years
so that,
after
that decision, yeah, 2018, that decision was made.
Yeah. Well, it was going to get built, but then he decided to move it. Then there was a decision in 2018.
Yeah.
So, but the thing is the whole process.
The crucial thing for those Malaysian developers up there was that having an arena meant that they could get a train station built, obviously immediate value uplift to all their. They're building 6,500
properties. Yeah.
6,500 properties up there. Yeah, yeah. New properties.
So. Some of the worst. By the way, now the southwest of England, I was told by a private house builder, he said the front doors just open straight onto the road. There's not even a thought of a garden, and they're built with breeze blocks in the most shoddy fashion I've ever seen. So yeah. that sort of estate is being built.
You're right next to the M5 and a massive shopping mall.
I wonder whether this arena is ever going to get built or it's just going to be more housing, because that's what everything seems to be being nowadays.
But the thing to bring back to housing again, what you've had in Bristol City Council, the executive, the senior officers, have been the same, their title is Executive Director for Growth and Regeneration. And they've been the people having oversight over this stuff, like the arena and this property and regeneration stuff in the city and housing. They've been under the same people. And this is one of the things that the council is now trying to do in response to this situation with housing. And this was a recommendation from Mr. Reacher from Southwark, that they have an executive director for housing. So one of the top tier of officers, you know, who knows if this will make a difference.
But it seems obvious.
But they'll have an executive director for housing.
I mean, it should be obvious, yeah. Shouldn't it? Isn't this one of the main things that a council does, is ensure that its people have got a roof over their head?
So and the people who, you know, been in that position of executive director for growth and regeneration are people, you know, who come in to local government, well, they seem to at Bristol City Council, you know, from these private sector backgrounds. You had Stephen Peacock, who I've been on the show talking about before, you know, who started his career at BP. You've now got a guy called John Smith, who was the, he was a lawyer at Burgess Salmon, and then the chief executive of Avon and Somerset Police Authority. And has, you know, someone who has quite serious questions to answer over what's been alleged by who's the chap, Anthony Stansfeld, who was the police and crime commissioner at Thames Valley, has made allegations that John Smith basically covered up fraud that was happening at Lloyd's in Bristol. He's now sitting there in Bristol City Council, you know, with responsibility for social housing. It just seems utterly bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, and also, you know, if a council is supposed to care about people who live in the city and to make sure they've got a roof over their head, well, the Bristol Post this week has published some figures on homelessness. In 2021, the number of rough sleepers, which of course is really the sort of sharp end of homelessness, counts logged by the city stood at 463. 2022-23, this number had increased up to 550. The latest figure from 2023 to 2024 has leapt again up to 615. These figures include duplicates, as someone sleeping rough might be seen more than once over the course of the year. So there is actually, you know, there's a big leap in homelessness, Martin, all this, at the same time as the council are being called out by the regulators for not looking after council housing. In your view, is this just to do with the austerity measures, or is it because the council's got other priorities than housing?
Well, I think it is the austerity measures. Let's not kid ourselves.
And this comes back
underlying all of this
to 2008, then, really.
Well, it goes further back. It goes to the sale of council houses from 1979 onwards.
2008 was the bit, was when the massive cutbacks to housing started. Local authority, what we used to call the rate support grant many years ago. Central government paying local authorities to run their cities. So a slice of the national tax pie that goes to local authorities.
Yes, and of course, because it was centrally administered, it's supposed to be distributed on the basis of need, which is, you know, calculated on super output areas and all the rest of it, which are the most deprived communities.
So if we really want to trace...
More deprived communities are supposed to get more money. But of course, the Tories fiddled it all to make sure that Tory areas got more money
than
Labour areas didn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite right, in fact, to make party political points. But at the end of the day, Gordon Brown in 2008 said, "I've saved the world." He did totally the opposite, didn't he? He sold us out by bailing out rather than letting some of these banks collapse in 2008.
Well, no, he's
made sure that the public finances are in a total mess ad infinitum.
All right, well, let's come back to the debates we had at the time in 2008. You could have let the banks collapse, but then, of course, you're not necessarily going to... That's going to have all sorts of knock-on effects. What you do is you bail the banks out, if you like, but then you've got to nationalise them and keep them nationalised.
They did.
Yes, they did, but then they sold them back to the private sector to carry on doing this. What's happened is that the banks, that the hedge funds and so on were bailed out. They should have been sent to prison, of course. Kenneth Galbraith's son, Peter Galbraith, who's based in Texas, was saying what you would expect to happen here is lots of chief executives of banks to be sent to prison, proper prison.
Well, in Iceland, they were.
Yes, they were. That's right. And that's what you do. And if you don't do that, you've actually given them a thumbs up to go back to doing exactly what they were doing before, which is exactly what has happened.
And in places like Iran, they get executed.
Well, in China as well. Yeah, if you, you know, the, I mean, but this is not. I mean, you know, Jack Ma, who's the most wealthy man in China, he tried to set up a fintech company, which is basically a bank, and they've got strong regulations about how you can set up banks. So this isn't a bank, mate. This isn't a fintech company. It's a bank. So they stopped him from doing it. The regulators stopped him, and then he disappeared from public life for several months. And everybody's, where's he gone? What's happened to him? Anyway, he then reappeared at the poorest village in China. And said, you know, I'd really like to apologise for everything I've done. I've been very, very bad. I shouldn't have tried to set this bank up without thinking, unthinkingly and so on. And, of course, I've got to help now to pull, you know, the poor people of China up by their bootstraps. And we're here in the poorest... Because, of course, the Communist Party make a big deal about the poorest village in China. You know, this is what we're about. And, of course, he then had to go and confess and so on. And he said, my application to join the Communist Party of China is under consideration. That's the way they do it there. As you say, in Iran, you might just end up swinging from a rope.
Here, they seem to give them knighthoods.
Yeah, well, yes, that's right. I mean,
HSBC.
I'm talking HSBC. When they were busted for, you know, basically money laundering in Mexico, Green, who was the head of it, was brought back by, you know, they'd been fined a load of money for money laundering for the cartels, and the guy who's in charge of it was brought in by Cameron to advise the government on tax policy. He should have been in prison.
Yeah, that's right. He was in the cabinet, wasn't he?
That's right.
Brought in, made a lord overnight, and then brought straight into the cabinet. Now, this is the Mexican prosecution, which was used as evidence, the fact that in something like half of the banks in Mexico, the HSBC, they'd adapted them so that people could deposit whole suitcases.
Yeah, so they changed so you come in with a suitcase of a certain
suitcase
size
of
with
cash.
Money and then just hand it over through.
That's the suitcase, by the way, that probably ended up on the desk of King Charles when he was Prince Charles, which he was admonished for accepting suitcases full of cash for. Anyway, Joe, look, what about this chief executive of Bristol City Council? You already mentioned him.
Yes, our white knight coming to the rescue.
Yes, well, we hope so. Anyway, it's interesting, isn't it? He's come from the very place the Greens have just been kicked out of, so he's quite clearly... Mm. In with the Greens. Now, I suppose you had a little look at how he got on in Brighton, but it's interesting to me that the Greens have chosen to pinch their old buddy from Brighton. Now they've been booted out in the local elections there.
Yes, he was... I mean, he's immediately come from Croydon, but he's only been there for the last couple of years.
Okay.
Before that, yeah, he was at Brighton and Hove Council for more than 25 years. Rising to the giddy heights of Executive Director of Economy, Environment and Culture. And so he was around when things all started going bad for the Greens in Brighton. They had that bin waste strike in October 2021. He was at the centre of that. Yeah, so that led to bin bags piling up in the streets of Brighton.
So we're going to get the same here, I suppose, are we?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's
that.
I mean,
well, they've said that they're talking now about possibly going down to monthly bin collections.
Right.
Here in
that's
Bristol.
Right, that's right. I got a Labour Party message about that. They want people to oppose the changing of the bin collections to once a month. But that is apparently what they're discussing doing.
Well, he wasn't very good at negotiating with the GMB union over that. This chap is Nick Hibbard, and they wrote to him when this was all going on. They wrote to the council and said, for over 10 weeks prior to strike action, we have been attempting to resolve this dispute before our members resorted to industrial action. But for that period of time, council officers repeatedly went round in circles and failed to deal with these issues we identified on behalf of our members. In fact, Nick Hibbard and Rachel Chassaud on a number of occasions went in denial mode about these issues. Some of the effects of these issues on our members culminated in one of our members suffering a heart attack and being hospitalised, but still management failed to deal with the issues.
So this is his legacy. It seems to me he's also going to be trying trying to, I mean, this is what we pay council tax for: collecting bins, keeping lights on, making sure that a zebra crossing light has got a bulb in it. This sort of basic stuff, and not necessarily for putting planters in the middle of the road. But it seems to me, Joe, that the priorities here are just simply to institute a new bunch of cuts. Now, I would have hoped, and most people who voted for the Greens didn't expect them to try and out-Tory the Tories.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's hard to know what's going on with them in Bristol. I mean, it looks, from the outside, it looks pretty shambolic. You know, there's no real sense of leadership or strategy that's evident. But again, you know, it's this strange situation where it's all done through policies. They don't have a majority quite. And yet they are perceived as, you know, being the new administration.
Seems like it's kind of managed collapse or managed dismantlement or something.
I remember back in the day when we had sort of Liberal Democrat and Labour Party neck and neck in terms of running the council. Neither of them wanted to actually run the council. So the Labour Party saying, well, you can run the council. The Lib Dems say to the Labour Party, no, you run the council.
Well, Labour,
nobody actually wanted to do it.
Labour have definitely said it. That's been their strategy. Is because they haven't even taken up the number of chairs of committees that they are entitled to, and have said basically, we're going to be the opposition. You're running the council with the Lib Dems.
And you can take all the flack.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll just snipe from the sidelines.
Yeah. Another thing about this guy, yeah, Nick Hibbard, is that he's an ocean kayaker. He actually competes for Great Britain as an ocean kayaker. So that led to the obvious...
If he needs to get across to Wales, he's probably going to do...
Well, it led to the Bristolian obviously doing a mock-up of him in a kayak, saying which way to... You know, Shit Creek.
he's off, yeah. Yeah, so he's got a few good hobbies, but, well, let's see. I mean, it'd be interesting to follow what happens with the bin collections, the light bulbs, the basic stuff. So what about... Okay, so we've got... Bristol's so well known for this story about Edward Colston and the dragging of the statue of this merchant venturer and slave trader into the drink, which was a great, I thought, fantastic popular action after years and years of campaigning to get this guy removed from the city centre, which is kind of rubbing everybody's nose, white and black, every colour you can imagine, in the dirt, by having this guy sort of there as some kind of hero. No statues to the people that ended the slave trade, the campaigners, etc., which I think Bristol is much more, that's the sort of flavour that the city would like to see. Anyway, so they dragged the statue, bronze statue, over, shoved it in the drink, and it's now, I think, in one of the museums.
It's in the MP, yeah.
Sit on its side with a lot of dents in it and a little bit of an explanation of to what happened there. Apparently there's finally a new plaque going up on the empty plinth, which seems like a bit of a committee fudge. Maybe the committee couldn't quite agree to what to put on the plinth, but they can agree maybe on a new plaque.
Well, it's been a very torturous process of deciding what was going to go on this new plaque on the empty plinth. And so there was, Marvin Rees, in 2020, after the statue was pulled down, Marvin Rees set up a history commission of made up mainly of local academics to decide sort of, you know, what the city's reactions to this would be.
Any of the merchant venturers by any chance?
Not that I've been aware of. No. Although there was a history commission, and there was something called the Legacy Foundation, which did have merchant venturers on it actually, but also had you know, a lot of people from Bristol with African heritage on it.
Well, they call them the great and the good, don't they? I think more of the sort of minuscule and the bad of various sorts, you know. But anyway,
you had these two bodies, and they had put together some wording, and then it went to a planning committee who had to approve this, and that happened back in February of this year. Basically, the Green councillors on the planning committee didn't like the wording, because it referred to, it said on the 13th of November 1895, A statue of Edward Colston, 1636 to 1721, was unveiled here, celebrating him as a city benefactor. And then it goes on and talks about in the late 20th and early 21st century, the celebration of Colston was increasingly challenged, given his prominent role in the enslavement of African people. Then it talks about the statue being pulled down and then it going into the museum. But they objected to this reference to him as a city benefactor.
Way, good people. Well said. I mean, you know, he was he's actually dragged the city's name through the dirt in many ways.
Yeah. But anyway. Although, I mean, you could make the argument that was just giving some historical context about why the statue was there.
Yeah, his rich friends at the time and the legacy that he left, the people who are now hanging on his coattails, rather like him and they want to big him up. But Bristol's not really like that.
Yeah. Well, they wanted to redo the wording. The chief planner said the committee could redo the wording. It then came back to the following committee with exactly the same wording because they'd said, no, this is the wording and you can't change it. So that again, they refused it. And then it's just come back again for the third time about a week ago. And they had just removed that reference to, you know, saying that the statue was put up to celebrate him as a city benefactor. And it went through with one objection, predictably, who was the notorious Conservative councillor, Richard Eddy, who said it was, he said it was utterly historical revision that is worthy of the Nazis.
Yeah, but it's not, is it, really? I mean, it's nothing like... In fact, if anything, you know, a slave trader is a Nazi rather than someone that's trying to point out that they're not a great benefactor for being a slave trader.
Yeah, well, I mean, Eddie seems to... I mean, Eddie is a guy who made a big thing... Who made a big thing about when Robinson's got rid of the gollywog on their jam.
Right. I mean, this is always being looked at, and academics look at it, ordinary people look at it, read their history books, and go, well, this guy wasn't such a great guy after all, was he? And I think we'd probably say the same for quite a lot of statues out there, but very few quite to the extent of Colston. So also, I know, you know, you have done your article, we call it the book, don't we, laughingly, because it's such a long article, about St. Mary Le Port development. Mm. And this is right in the city centre. It's I hate using the word iconic, but it is right next to Bristol Bridge, which is where the city started, on the edge of Castle Park, which is one of the great sort of recreation places in Bristol city centre. And so what is actually going on with this big development? I just try in a nutshell, put in a nutshell what you found out about it, which was that the community assessment that goes in as part of the planning application wasn't really the community at all. It was a setup by friends of the big developers. So they were making it look as if all the local people supported it, whereas actually they didn't. And they were recruiting people like local law firms to send their staff in to go and do litter picks and trying to make out that this was that the local people really, really liked the place.
Yeah.
And
that's why basically an astroturfing community group,
yeah,
which was actually just a Facebook group that a guy had set up with the support of the councillor with cabinet responsibility for planning in the city.
Yeah, but let's be clear, it's an absolute monstrosity stuck right in the middle of the historic heart of the city,
completely out of scale of what's left of the old city. Because of course, you know, half of the old city was destroyed in German bombing in 1940.
They were supposed to start digging in January this year. Mm. So what's happening?
Yeah, they've had planning permission for over two years now, and nothing's happened until about a week ago. Documents went up on the council's planning portal, which was the developers' proposals for their phased demolition and development.
Okay, so is this a way of just keeping that planning permission going? So
no, this looks like the real thing. Right. So it looks like they're want to get on with it now.
Right. Well, we shall see.
And one thing I'm wondering about the timing of this. I've seen that the planning officer, the planning manager, who was absolutely central, who wrote the report that went before the planning committee, and was the key player within the planning department for getting this through, even though the planning department had been saying for 6 months in their pre-application discussions with the developer that the scale of these three office blocks didn't conform to Bristol's local plan, you know, that it wasn't compliant with their policies, and that they had to reduce the scale. But the developer refused to do that, and this planning officer, together with the head of development management, you know, then sat in that planning committee meeting and recommended that the councillors vote it through. Well, that guy has been away on sabbatical for the last year, and he's just come back, literally in the last week or so.
Okay,
he's
so
back
he's,
in the office.
What's he been doing in his sabbatical?
Well, I don't know. They talked about, before he left,
a book about how to get monstrous planning applications through.
He was on a wine tasting tour in California, I think.
Right.
But I wonder if it's the timing, you know, because I've been wondering, you know, what are they doing with this development? They're not doing anything. And you've only got 3 years after planning permission is granted that you've got to get spades in the ground. Otherwise, you lose that planning.
How many spades do you need to stick in the ground? One.
So one
spade in the ground.
You've got to just turn over a sod, and that's you've started. Okay. Yeah, and you keep your planning permission.
Okay.
But it looks to me like they're serious now about moving on with this.
Yeah. Well, interesting. Well, keep track of that, Joe. Yeah. Thanks ever so much for coming in and sharing all that with us. We're going to go on to another story now. Unless you've got anything to add. Which is Gaza. Obviously, we are particularly concerned about what's happening over there. On this programme, there is, in fact, a public meeting taking place, which we're hoping to give you some information about next week, about the number of arrests that there have been over the Gaza issue. But let's have a listen now to the BBC's excellent little programme, which was on last week. And in fact, it's a bit of a series. It's called The Conflict. And they're looking at the whole history, the context, the stuff we've been trying to do about why we are where we are in Gaza today.
The attack on the King David Hotel, the hanging of two British sergeants, the intra-communal violence, Deir Yassin, Hadassah. Mm. They're all reminders, aren't they, that militants and violent militias are nothing new in Israel and what was known as Palestine. They too echo down the decades.
They do, yeah. I mean, I've worked with and filmed, quite unusually, it's very difficult to get close to them, what's known as the Hilltop Youth, who are a violent extremist group of settlers, Jewish settlers, mainly on the West Bank, but they have also made their presence felt on the border with Gaza in the last year, trying to physically break through. And the United States has sanctioned this organization as a violent extremist organization, shades of history again with that. And the Hilltop Youth regard what they call as Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, as Israel's, and they use violent means. And there has been extreme violence and even deaths in the last year from this movement.
Do you see the echoes from the founding moments of the State of Israel into what its posture is now?
I mean, it just continues. As you said, it's all part of history. And each side makes their own, you know, their own pitch, if you like. So many of the leaders on both sides in some of these militant organizations went on to become political figures. They become famous and they become followed and they become, you know, hero worshipped through the violence. And they then move into the political space. We've even seen, you know, right-wing nationalist ministers now from amongst the settler movement as part of Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition government. So these things are all quite fraught and quite difficult.
Right. I think its politics have changed. I think the role of violence in defending settlements during the 1930s and there was a famous British officer, Ord Wingate, who went on to fight with the Chindits, who organised groups of special night squads, they were called. They sound very much like the Hilltop
Yep.
Youth. Mm. And they were there and they were mounting ambushes, sort of counter raids on the Arabs who were attacking their settlements. So there's that. That's lurking in there. Israel started off as a socialist idea, essentially. It was about kibbutzes and about people moving there and turning the land, you know, sort of greening the land.
Yeah.
It has moved steadily rightwards, and that journey is still going on today.
So that's a clip from an excellent BBC, I don't often say that, do I? An excellent BBC programme on the context and the history of what's been going on in the Middle East. And of course, this is nice to see the BEEB doing this, because it is the British's responsibility, Martin, really, isn't it, what's going on today?
Well, historically, certainly so, because obviously the British army seized what is now Palestine in 1917, Lawrence of Arabia and all of that, and the Balfour Declaration allowed the creation, ultimate creation of the State of Israel.
I mean, is it fair for the Brits to say, well, it's nothing to do with us, these people we thought were going to be nice, they picked up guns, the Irgun, the Zionist terrorists, and started shooting British soldiers and blowing us up?
Well, at the time, as Joe will remember, Joe's hero, Ernie Bevin, who was the Foreign Secretary, Labour Foreign Secretary at the time, he was opposed to the creation of the State of Israel, partly because of the methods that the Irgun and the Haganah had used to get it. So anything, if we allow them to do that and get a state on the back of it, that will create problems, because he was quite an imperialist, it will create problems everywhere else, because everybody else will think, well, that's what we do. If we kill enough British soldiers, they'll give up and they can get what you want.
Okay,
so he was opposed to it.
Well, we hear a lot, don't we, about God gave us this land. To what extent were the people, the Haganah, the people with the guns back in 1948 and since, to what extent were they actually religious?
They were secular nationalists. But you've now got religious, religious nationalists.
That means they're not religious. So God gave them the land. Is this just an excuse?
The original Zionist. Don't forget the conception. Lloyd George was very important in the Balfour Declaration. It was actually sort of Christian providentialism. You know, they were the ones who were keen on it. And in actual fact, Montagu, who was a member of the cabinet, British cabinet, conservative member of British cabinet in 1917, he was the only Jewish member of the cabinet. He said, I'm opposed to this. This is going to cause all kinds of trouble, because you're basically saying that Jews can't live anywhere except in Israel, which is what he's basically saying. There's no reason to do this. But there were both kind of ideological reasons from a sort of biblical point of view for people like Lloyd George. And also, of course, they thought that somebody said, we need a little Ulster here to protect the Suez Canal, because the British at that stage saw themselves as, exceptionalist nation. You know, we're entitled to move things around, create states, make states disappear. And that's so, the creation of the State of Israel was a largely British endeavour. And that's why the Palestinians, quite rightly, see the British as responsible for their fate. Because we are, not us, but, our state.
So, but what about the question I asked you, which is about whether, it was fair for the Brits to say, hang on, we had no idea these guys were going to pick up guns and start blowing us up.
Well, in actual fact, Ord Wingate, who organised the Haganah, was also the organiser of the Chindits in Burma. So, in actual fact, the elements within the British Armed Forces were very, very sympathetic to the Zionist terrorist movement, to the extent of arming, training them and directing them.
And what about, because I know there was, I remember reading, this is about 3 or 4 years ago, the threat to assassinate Winston Churchill.
Well, they did assassinate Lord Moyne, who was Churchill's mate, who was the British, representative in Palestine. And they also killed Count Bernadotte, who was the UN's special representative of Palestine. And they killed loads and loads of Jews they didn't like, and Palestinian civilians. They've got there's a book called State of Terror by Thomas Suarez, who I think we've had on this show not long ago. It's all about, because he went through all the documents of the British occupation forces at that time, and he just showed how absolutely ruthless and extremely violent the Zionist terrorist movement was. They pioneered things like the car bomb and the letter bomb, for example. They invented them. Now ubiquitous.
Well, it's all very well for armchair generals like you, and well, it's possibly I. Maybe I'm an armchair corporal. I don't know, but to pontificate about these things. But much more, I think, genuine to have medical staff who are actually dealing with the literally bits of bodies on the ground and injured people. We're joined in the studio by Dr. Chris Hook, who has been out in Gaza working with Médecins Sans Frontières. Hi, Chris.
Hi there, thanks for having me.
And I think maybe we should just start by going straight to Gaza. So I'm very privileged through the 16th of October media group over there, of which Wafa Aludani, who was killed a couple of months ago, she was the founder of it, but there are still quite a few people part of that group who are trying to get the news out to us here in the outside world. There's been a horrific campaign like I don't think the world has ever seen to kill journalists who are reporting there and getting information about war crimes, evidence of war crimes out. We saw, didn't we, last week, the issuing of the Gallant and Netanyahu arrest warrants by the International Criminal Court. So before we hear from Gaza, Martin, do you just want to say how you whether you think this was a big move? I suppose people in Palestine will say, well, so what?
Well, I think they're grateful that it's happened. Too little, too late, obviously, but I don't suppose they're going to turn their noses up at something like that. It all builds the pressure on the government.
It means, for example, that Netanyahu can't travel, except maybe to the United States.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I mean, of course, also, it's quite clear the Trump administration has no intention whatsoever they've actually threatened Khan, who's the British head of the International Criminal Court, just as they threatened Fatou Bensouda, who previously
said the International Court of Justice, I think.
No, I'm talking about the International Criminal Court, ICC.
Right. Isn't it the ICJ that's issued the arrest warrant?
I'm not quite sure. Hang on. No, because the International Court of Justice is the one that's ruled that Palestine is occupied and therefore the Israelis have got to withdraw from occupied territory. But the International Court of Justice is part of the UN system.
Yeah.
The International Criminal Court is a much weirder beast set up really to deal with, you know, the West's enemies in Yugoslavia and Africa, which is why, but you know, British and US politicians say, well, it's not for us. That's just for the bad guys in Africa and Yugoslavia.
Okay. Let's have a listen now. Here's Fatima speaking from northern Gaza, literally recorded just last night.
Hello, this is a Palestinian talking to you from the besieged Gaza Strip, the place that is under Israeli genocide since the 7th of October 2023 until this day. Which means that the Palestinians are living under genocide since 14 months of displacement, of starvation, of ethnic cleansing, of apartheid, of systematic killing, of targeting Palestinian children and women, of detaining Palestinian men and elderly. Of targeting the Knights of the Truth, I mean the journalists. And I'm here today to shed light on the suffering of my people. Actually, this is the second time the Palestinians are experiencing a very harsh and cold weather due to the circumstances of displacement and starvation. Unlike the other world who are celebrating themselves to welcome the winter season and its vibes, the Palestinians in Gaza, especially who prefer the winter season and its vibes, started hating this season due to the circumstances they are living in. The Palestinians are being displaced in tents that cannot keep them warm. We see our children and kids being bare hands and feet. There is nothing to warm them. There is nothing to feed them due to the policy of starvation that Israel occupation is pursuing against Palestinians since the beginning of this genocide. According to UNRWA reports, over 2 million displaced people in the Gaza Strip are trapped in dark conditions, besieged by hunger, thirst, and disease. And for many families, securing a meal has become an impossible challenge. For the Palestinian children who has nothing to feed, nothing to eat, due to the policy of starvation. There are 30% of Gaza's children suffer from severe malnutrition. As I talked about the circumstances of displacement and the harsh vibes instead of the cold, instead of the rainy vibes that Palestinians used to entertain themselves with and take, like, we can say, film them in their mobiles as previous, as in the, as like, in the, in their previous normal life before the genocide. Now they are being sheltering, or they are taking the schools as a shelter for them, but 95% of these schools have been destroyed by Israel occupation missiles, and there are 2,500 Palestinians need urgent medical evacuation. And this is, we know, as you know, the crossings, are all the crossings in Gaza are being closed, and patients cannot travel to receive a treatment outside, and this really hurts their health conditions. So the situation in Gaza is extremely difficult.
So that's Fatima, recorded last night for this program. Thanks, Fatima. And she ends the report, we'll hear the second half a bit later, by thanking everybody who's supporting the Palestinians around the world, even though their situation is so awful. It's lovely to hear them focusing on the positive. Chris, this is amazing to think that people in such a situation can still do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've got to find every small bit of positive they can in any of their situation, haven't they? There's, you know, everything is so dire for them at the moment that, that anything of any positivity is really important to cling on to. And I think pretty much all that's left is that sort of solidarity of people in the rest of the world still sort of talking about their situation and trying to help.
Yeah, and making small changes. Like, you're quite right, Martin, it is the International Criminal Court that's issued these warrants. The French have said Netanyahu can come to France because Israel never signed the treaty which formed the International Criminal Court. Britain not saying quite the same. What's your assessment, Chris, about the profession and how it's dealing with this? Are there still people going out to Gaza? Are medical professionals still able to get in? Because, I mean, we keep hearing almost all the hospitals have been flattened.
Yeah, so now Gaza relies very heavily on essentially field hospitals, which are tents or temporary buildings that have been put up. In fact, the UK government actually finances via UK Med, a very large organisation, finances two rather large field hospitals. So with one hand we giveth and the other hand we taketh away. So medical professionals are still getting in. Plenty of people from the UK are still able to get in, but the supplies don't. And so everybody now is really desperately fighting for any sort of supply. Trucks are piling up, they're looted on the way in now because the situation is so desperate. So as much as you can have buildings and you can have staff, if you don't have even the basic medical equipment and basic supplies to treat people, outcomes are just getting worse and worse and worse. And that's in the good part, which is, you know, the south/middle area. In the north, we know it's absolutely catastrophic. MSF have got 7 members of staff trapped in Jabalia, unable to leave, unable to move, unable to get anywhere, because they were caught near Al Aldus Hospital where they were supporting people, and now can't move because of troops. So the situation up in the north is literally end of days sort of stuff, and down in the south it's really appalling. Friends that are there and people I stay in regular contact with are literally saying, you know, the flour is running out again. You know, there's no fruit and vegetables in the market and hasn't been for weeks and weeks now. And whereas previously we have sort of thought, you know, maybe this is sort of fluctuating up and down a little bit with supplies getting in and out. No, there's been nothing for a long, long while now, and it's absolutely, absolutely desperate.
Well, Martin, this is part of the reason the ICC have decided, isn't it? They're saying that there's a policy of deliberate starvation, and it's very difficult for people like Chris to go and take on a situation where, even if somebody is helped to some form of recovery by medics, that then they may face starvation.
Well, I mean, you say that the French are going to allow Netanyahu to come to France because they're claiming that Israel is not a signatory to the International Criminal Court, but Palestine is. and it's now a recognised UN body. So it's if Palestine, as the ICJ has said, is occupied, then of course they fought that land falls under the jurisdiction of Palestine, and therefore they do fall.
Well, we know what the French are like. I don't think Netanyahu would get a very warm reception.
Well, I think this is. I think he could go to France, but he might find that he gets warm reception, as you say. I mean, this is absolutely appalling. I mean, we are watching a whole people basically being starved to death in front of us, and we could, you know, the Americans could stop this straight away. They're just going to pick up a telephone and say, "We're going to cut off your weapons supply," and that would be it. They'd have to crumble. They've done that. Well, in the past, they've done that.
We're having a new emperor in January. Do you think that's going to make any difference?
Well, it's going to make it worse because he's the funders of Trump, Miriam Adelson. She's gave him $100 million on the promise that he would allow the West Bank to be annexed.
Hang on, he said, and I think it was in Madison Square Garden, like about a fortnight before he was elected, Trump said, "I am going to sort out the chaos in the Middle East. I promise, I'm going to sort it out."
Well, he can say that, but what he means is that we potentially are going to have a nuclear war here with Iran. Iran hasn't got nuclear weapons yet, but they're talking about maybe getting them. We still haven't had the Iranian counterstrike to the Israeli strike on Iran. We've had the ceasefire in Lebanon now, which is not necessarily going to hold for that long. That's all messy. The whole world is, you know, as we come, it's Merry Christmas, isn't it? You know, it'll all be over by Christmas, as I've said before, and that if we're unlucky, it really will, because none of us are going to be here.
So for people that you've spoken to, Chris, how are they dealing with it over there?
I mean, they have absolutely no hope that a new US president is going to make any difference other than making their situation worse. They've seen what happened before when Trump was in, recognising Jerusalem as the Israeli capital, granting them absolute sort of freedom in the Golan Heights and stuff. And now they absolutely know what's going to come, is that, you know, Gaza will be taken away from them. And that's how Trump believes he's going to end the war, I think, is by just giving Israel pretty much everything they want in return for slowly but surely stopping the bombings. But I mean, on the ground, yeah, there's no belief that the ICC arrest warrants will make any difference. I think everybody there realizes that nobody in the West is actually going to arrest Netanyahu should he step on these shores. They'd be immediately kicked out of office. I don't think everybody's desperate for some bit of hope. People now seeing the ceasefire in Lebanon see that as a good positive sign. But deep down, it's hard to reconcile this idea that they will not be allowed to go back to Gaza City and to the north, that is being flattened systematically now in their absence. And that is clearly going to be a patch of land that's never returned to the people of Gaza. And they are going to be stuck in this horrendous humanitarian zone, as it's called, down in the south, probably for many, many years to come.
Well, mentioning Lebanon, the latest on the ceasefire is the Lebanon ceasefire is faltering after Israel has launched attacks into Lebanon. The US assured Israel it could act against Hezbollah under a truce. But looking at Gaza particularly, Israel has killed 48 Palestinians over the last 24 hours there in Gaza. I don't know if they were all Hamas terrorists holding guns and trying to be anti-Semitic, but I would imagine that most of those people are almost certainly simply civilians, because that's the huge majority of the death toll.
Well, we know statistically 60% of those will be women and children, as has been for the previous.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that this lady reporting for us, Fatima, she said last week she was talking about how many men had been abducted. It's just the idea that if you're a man of fighting age, Israelis will just simply imprison you.
Absolutely. We lost MSF lost a very senior orthopedic surgeon just a few weeks ago, who was operating in the north and had been there for the entire conflict. No suggestion whatsoever that this man has ever held a gun in his entire life, literally operating on people who've been exploded, but marched out at gunpoint and hasn't been seen or heard of since. So I think, yeah, that's what happens if you are a male aged between about 10 and 80, I think. So
trying to get to the bottom of what's really going on, US firms have been competing for huge contracts to control North Gaza security, Martin.
Well, I mean, this is the vultures. There's an ill wind that blows nobody to good, eh? It's very dangerous situation.
So what, when the IDF move out, we're going to have American private security companies moving in. That's what it's saying. What's what they're saying?
Well, the fighters, the Hamas fighters, are still in the tunnels in both parts of the Gaza.
We've seen this before, haven't we? And we got ISIS as a result and stuff. So nothing good is going to come of that sort of situation. There needs to be a complete withdrawal, and just, you know, accept that the borders were already there. The damage has been done. Gaza has been set back for decades. There's not going to be any major force from them for a long time to come. And the need for American forces on the ground is only going to escalate things worse.
We were talking about Trump, weren't we? Scott Ritter is a former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer. He was also the prime mover for the looking for the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq all those years ago. And he did the right thing. He put his hand on his heart and he resigned when they decided they were going to launch a war after he'd looked everywhere and couldn't find any WMD. He walked. But anyway, he's very, very chatty these days, and if you find him up on YouTube or BitChute or Rumble, you will find, I'm sure, Scott Ritter talking. He was arrested a month or a half ago, and his place was gone through by the FBI, but they haven't actually pursued any prosecutions against him. And he starts to go into some of what Martin was saying here about the characters that are involved from the United States, the Christian Zionists, and particularly this guy, I'm not sure what his first name is, Senator, I think he's a senator, not sure actually what he is, Huckabee, who's Trump wants to be the new, and we'll be probably hearing quite a lot from this chap, ambassador from the United States to Israel. And he explains a little bit about the sort of twisted thinking going on in the Christian Zionists' heads.
Let's take a look at his cabinet picks, you know, like foreign policy. The first thing we have to note is that this was never going to be good for Palestine. We knew that. We knew that a Trump administration was never going to be good for Palestine, except it may turn out to be the best thing that ever happened to Palestine. And I'll tell you why. We know that the Biden administration had sold out to Israel. And I mean, you know, look, these are the guys that said, you know, if Israel doesn't allow aid into Gaza, we're going to cut off military shipments in 30 days. And they timed it so that 30 days was after the election. Now here we are after the election, and the aid didn't roll in, and Biden says, "Ah, that's okay. No, we're just going to continue supporting Israel no matter what. It doesn't matter that, because the reality is, we're incapable of supporting the Palestinian people." Biden's gone; he's out. Trump is in. Elise Stefanik, she's at the United Nations. She is hardcore pro-Israel, insanely pro-Israel. I want to remind everybody that Elise Stefanik, as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, does not make policy. So please never mention her name again, because she is irrelevant. People will say, well, what about Mike Huckabee, the U.S. ambassador to the, I mean, this to Israel? This guy's dangerous, because he's one of those born-again Christian evangelical Zionists that believes in the rapture and Armageddon, and that we have to support Israel, not because we like the Jews. Actually, I just newsflash to people. Evangelical Zionists, they hate the Jews because the Jews are evil. Let's study the rapture a little bit more, will we? And understand what happens when the Messiah comes back. And, you know, there's this war. And then the believers, Christians, rise up and go to heaven. And then everybody else stay behind. Guess who stays behind? The evil, satanic Jews. They don't go to heaven because they're evil. So all you pro-Israeli idiots out there that are saying, thank God for evangelical Christians, they hate you. They despise you. They're using you to achieve suicidal rapture. And that is Mike Huckabee. But he is the ambassador. He doesn't make policy. He implements policy. So don't worry about him. Who implements policy? Marco Rubio, Secretary of State. His name is there. And then this Secretary of Defense's name that I can't pronounce because nobody knew about him before any of this.
The Fox News guy.
Yeah. You know, he's there. Then, of course, we have the National Security Advisor, who's, you know, rabidly pro-Israel, anti-Iranian, and all that kind of stuff. And people say, well, Scott, how could you possibly, you know, make these turds smell like roses? Because it's pretty bad. you do understand that the only person who makes policy in the Trump administration is Donald Trump. I'll say it one more time just so people understand. The only person who makes policy in the Trump administration is Donald Trump. Now, Trump has said that he doesn't want a war. Trump has said that he wants to improve the economy. So if Marco Rubio thinks he comes in on day one and says, hey, Donald, let's go to war against Iran, or let's support the Taiwanese so we get to a point of conflict with China, Trump's going to say, no, that's not happening. Not happening. And he'll be backed by the Secretary of Defense. Everybody's down on this guy. There's a lot to be down on. I mean, he's a Fox News host. He's sort of weird. But this is a guy who participated in successive war games at the Pentagon against China. And he says, we lost them all. He knows the reality of the state of affairs of the American military. So when you have a Secretary of Defense who knows that if we go to war against China right now, we're going to lose because we don't have the capacity to do it, who knows that we can't win a war on the ground in Europe, suddenly you took war out of the equation. And this is also a guy who said, number one job, Secretary of Defense, is to rebuild the American military, but at the same time, reform the military-industrial complex. He says it's highly inefficient, costs too much money, we don't get the bang out of the buck. This is a reformer. A reformer. Yes, he's a Fox News host, but he's a reformer. So Rubio comes in and says, war. The Secretary of Defense goes, can't afford it, got to rebuild. So Trump says to Rubio, no war, go out there and fix things. But that's not the most important position because neither one of them makes policy. The most important position is the person that comes into the White House every morning and briefs the president on the intelligence. That sets the stage. It used to be the job of the CIA. Ray McGovern, whom I think you know and your audience knows, a former CIA intelligence analyst, used to be the guy who briefed did the presidential daily brief. CIA doesn't do that anymore. The presidential daily brief is done by the Director of National Intelligence. And it's the Director of National Intelligence that arrives at the White House every morning and briefs the president in person about the state of the world. Every intelligence professional at that level for the past 30 years is a liar, somebody who can't be trusted, somebody who has allowed intelligence to be politicized, to be manufactured, people who sold us weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, people who sold us the war in Ukraine, who sold us Syria, sold us, Iraq, who sold us everything. They lie, they lie, they lie, they lie. Their job is to fix the intelligence around the policy that the president seeks to implement. And that's why we fail. Tulsi Gabbard has integrity. She's a serving member of the United States Army. She's been to war. And if people criticize her because she had the audacity to say that Bashar al-Assad is a legitimate leader of Syria.
So there's a take on the incoming administration. Martin, quite interesting, isn't it, to hear that he's saying the most important person is Tulsi Gabbard.
Well, it is important.
Trump's decision, but yes, he's going to be informed by her.
As he said, the CIA used to fulfill that role, and she ain't the CIA. So the CIA will still exist, and it will still have its point of view, and they will still be working behind the scenes to get what they want done. She's got some positive features to do. I mean, he's obviously, what he's done, Trump, is he's put someone like her in and RFK Jr. to balance the team that he's got. So there's some hope that maybe, because Trump is so mercurial, he may just decide, well, this war's costing too much money, get on the phone to Netanyahu and say, call it off, mate. That might be, but I think it's very, very unlikely.
So what do you make of what he was saying about Huckabee and the Christian Zionists, actually delighting in the fact that the Jews are going to hell, the satanic Jews, he calls them, are going to hell, and rubbing their hands because the Israelis are going to help people like Huckabee and his pals go to heaven?
Well, it's crazy. You can imagine, if you're the Iranian or Russian general staff and you're looking at people like that in charge on the American side, you just think, you know, we can't really deal with these people. There's no rational discussion to be had with them, is there?
So where do you think it's going? Which direction is it heading when Trump gets in? What's going to happen, do you think? Well, I mean, before, it's a crystal ball moment, really.
Before he gets in, we're still waiting for the Iranian response to the attack on them. They, I understand, have been holding back because there's still potential ceasefire with Hamas. Hezbollah, obviously, they haven't signed this deal, but they've gone along with it because they've got to stay in with the rest of the Lebanese society. And ultimately, I think what I think may happen, and perhaps this is what I would like to happen, I would like to see the Israeli army given the Ukrainian army treatment by the Iranians and the Russians. Just kill them all off. 500,000.
So you think there's no possibility of some sort of peace process or, for even just cutting off... Americans cutting off aid to Israel, which... Everything would grind to a halt.
Yeah, but yes, and of course Reagan famously phoned Begin back in 1982 when Beirut was being devastated and said, you better stop this, stop now, or I'll cut off your weapons supply. But he was a Republican. And of course, Democrats often were more permissive towards the Israelis. But that style of Republicanism in the US is dead and gone. They are actually, they're a danger to themselves and the rest of humanity. I'm sure that the Russian general staff, as we speak, are preparing for World War III, as are the Iranians. The Israelis just think that they will be swept away in the tide if it does go that way. They've got no strategic depth. They can't retire. Under modern conditions with hypersonic weapons and drones, you cannot actually concentrate your forces at all. If you try and concentrate your forces, they immediately get whacked. The Israeli army is incredibly vulnerable. It's a World War II army in World War III. So they could easily lose. And that's what they need to consider.
Yeah, and I think there's plenty of people in Palestine hoping that they do and that they have to sort of back off one way or another. I would suppose that they probably prefer to have American security guards in there rather than the IDF taking pot shots on the ground and also, of course, bombing them. But let's just wind up this section talking about Gaza and the Middle East handing back over for the second part of this piece from Fatima, recorded last night in Gaza itself, where she talks about, you know, what are people talking about over there? How are they keeping their heads together in the middle of a genocide?
One of the policies that is that to really harm my people in Gaza, and especially in this season, is that Israeli authorities have blocked the entry of blankets, clothing, and shoes into Gaza for over a year, depriving Palestinian children of essential supplies amid harsh winter conditions and the catastrophic humanitarian crisis. So the people are being displaced in tents that cannot keep them warm, that cannot, protect them from the cold and bitter cold weather. And we have so many people sought refuge in tents that their tents have been destroyed due to the harsh and cold winter conditions. So the people are, like, we can say that the suffering of Palestinian people in this season is being doubled. There's another issue that 15,000 pregnant Palestinian women in Gaza are on the brink of starvation due to the Israel war of extermination and starvation. This is according to UNRWA's report. So all of these things, all of these catastrophic incidents, all of these all of these tragic indicate one thing, that indicate the real intention of Israel occupation, which is not to deal we can say that it is not about the 7th of October, it is not about the resistance, it is just about Gaza, the Palestinians itself. They want to blur the Palestinian identity. They want to eliminate Gaza, eliminate the Palestinians from the earth. And there is something I personally read on Twitter for a German lawyer and political scientist called Milan. He said, Gaza, the prelude of the end of humanity. And I personally agree with this. And every Palestinian, I talk in the behalf of every Palestinian, that every Palestinian said, this is truly, this is absolutely true. Because if there is a humanity, all the people will move. All the leaders, all the political leaders will move, will at least say something and try to, at least try to judge Netanyahu and Gallant for after the recent arrest warrant that have been issued by the ICC. But actually, because there's no humanity, so nobody can move and nobody have the intention to move. And I personally thank all the people who organized the demonstrations in support of Palestine, and all the people who really care about Palestine and really demand an end to the Palestinian suffering, to the Israeli genocide in Gaza. This is a thank you from me and from every single Palestinian in Gaza. Thank you so much.
Well, that's Fatima over in Gaza with the eerie sound of the drone trying to drown her out as she's thanking the organisers of the demonstration. So, Martin, this whole concept, and maybe you, Chris, actually, someone that's actually been there, this concept of the beginning of the end of humanity, this has been going on for over a year, was it 14 months or so now? And you can see why people are beginning to despair. And there seems to be no end. We're talking about something like 40 or 50 innocent people being killed every day. The world seems impotent.
Yeah, I mean, so far we've demonstrated that we have absolutely no ability to truly influence this conflict from the outside, and the only people that can are the leaders, the leadership of Israel. I think to call it the end of humanity or the beginning of the end of humanity, I think humanity has had its severe weaknesses in similar fashion many times in the past, and I think we need to be a bit careful about calling for the elimination of hundreds of thousands of other people and things like that just because of this violence begetting violence and escalation and stuff. I don't think that's the way that we want any of this to go, regardless of what's happened. But it does. It shows the absolute impotence of us in the West, and this idea that we have any power and control over anything, I guess sort of quite rightly is being dismissed before our very eyes. But in a very sad manner, in that, we have what we consider and call, an ally in Israel, to our country, exercising their own force in a manner in which I think our own society don't believe should ever really happen anymore. And, it's an absolute shame that from day one, our governments, now two of them have done almost nothing to even try and influence that situation. I hope that it ends very, 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 very soon. The people on the ground are desperate for that, and just for the killing to stop, and everybody to take a breath and be able to have that moment of pause and say, okay, well, what now? But at least we're not dying, like you say, 40, 50 innocent people a day, and then have from there, let's try and rebuild. But I'm not sure there's much hope for the people of Gaza or from the people of Gaza at the moment. Let's see.
Well, it was had a great privilege. I think it was around about 2012 on this show, live actually, and I was quite surprised by his answer of interviewing Alan Frank. I think it was Alan Frank. Gosh, I can't remember his second name. But anyway, he was a BBC correspondent in the 1960s and 70s, and he got to know Israeli prime ministers, people like Golda Meir, etc. And he'd known Yasser Arafat, he'd known Sadat from Egypt back in those days. And I remember asking him, I said, well, what do you think is the solution to this Middle East peace. Can we get peace? And he said there is no solution because the Israelis don't want a solution. Is that fair, Martin? I mean, this is the problem, isn't it? We don't want to be too negative about this, but even professionals like Alan have said that he believes that this is they actually want this to get worse. They don't want the peace process to happen. And we know, don't we, that Rabin was assassinated by some friends of Netanyahu back in 1995 when they'd nearly brokered a proper peace agreement.
Well, I think that's right, but it isn't just... I mean, the Israelis are dependent upon the US in a different world, and it wouldn't be that difficult to imagine such a world. As I mentioned Reagan earlier, he called... You know, he basically pulled the... He told the Israelis, you've got to get out of the Lebanon. And the same with Eisenhower and Kennedy. They realised that the Israelis needed saving from themselves, and they used to take quite a robust line with them. That's what's missing here. I mean, they've always been pushing for the maximum of their demands, but they wouldn't be able to do anything. I mean, Israel is essentially a welfare state paid for by the US taxpayer. If the US taxpayer stopped paying for it, it wouldn't exist.
Alan Hart, it was.
Alan Hart, I was trying to remember his
name. He's the author of these three-part series, each of which book is probably like 2 inches thick, called Zionism, the Real Enemy of the Jews. And he, before he died, put all his effort in his retirement into clarifying for the world what was really going on behind the scenes over there. So, anyway, let's move on to talk now a little bit about... another cheerful subject. Assisted dying. What is it, Chris? Is it assisted dying or assisted suicide? Because it seems to me that there's an attempt to sort of put a little bit of polish on the pill here to try and make people think, oh, it's not really about suicide. But how's this going down with you and within the medical profession?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's assisted suicide. No, I think the medical profession will always be split on this issue, as is the public. Lots of different views and stuff. But I think most medical professionals are very good at looking quite dispassionately at topics like this now and saying, look, we witness people in great suffering. We have autonomy of decision making about which healthcare we receive and what we don't. Until that very last moment when your choice is either suffer greatly or suffer slightly less greatly. And I think we need to have a sensible, open, honest discussion about this, and the rhetoric from both sides sometimes gets a bit much, and for people to start saying that that this is a steady, obvious, slippery slope towards suicide in great forms, and that the idea that people just having a bad day would be able to just suddenly say, oh, actually, that's it, I'm going to go and get this pill or this injection. That's not what's going to happen. But what we do need is we need better palliative care. We need better options for people who do have severe end-of-life pain and distress. And we need to have an open, honest debate about, what are the risks and benefits of such a, the assisted dying bill, and not too much of the extremes being put forward as the ultimate end of such a thing.
So, I mean, I was listening to the debate on the radio on 5 Live. It was quite cheeky, actually. Sky had it on the television, and they had the entire debate by the woman who was Kim Leadbitter, who was proposing this bill. And then as soon as someone... came on the television to speak against it, they went, oh no, they cut them out, and they had the commentators chit-chatting over what they were saying, which I thought was a bit naughty, actually. Diane Abbott spoke in that when I was listening, and she said some interesting stuff about Canada's experience, saying that this was introduced in 2016 in Canada, something very similar to this bill, and then in 2021 they started to introduce it also for handicapped people and people who weren't terminally ill, and in a few years' time, it will be also okay for mental patients to take this. So it sounds like it's almost like a kind of, you say it may not be a slippery slope, but it could be a slippery slope to euthanasia. This is, or not euthanasia, to eugenics. So this is a whole bunch of people who are no longer of any but utility to society being elbowed out of the way. But look, before you reply, Chris, can we actually hear from the woman who did put the put this in the House of Parliament today, whose private member's bill it is, Kim Ledbetter? What did she have to say?
The law is not clear, and it does not protect individuals, families, or medical professionals. And this drives people to very desperate measures. And what about coercion? Well, as senior KCs have said, there is currently no established system for identifying abuse or coercion in advance of a person's death. Yeah. And for helping vulnerable people to make end-of-life decisions. So basically, Mr.
Will
Speaker...
Will my honourable friend give way?
I will give way on that.
I thank my honourable friend for giving way. Mr. Speaker, I've been a nurse for more than a quarter of a century, and in that time I've worked mostly in intensive care as a specialist there. I've worked with really compassionate and very skilled, well-trained clinicians who've been taught to spot coercion. It's fundamental to our practice. Will my honourable friend agree with me that it is wrong to suggest that clinicians cannot spot coercion in these cases?
Yeah. He makes a very important point, and I thank him for his intervention, and I thank him for his years of service as a nurse. I've spoken to many medical professionals about this issue, and they will say that this is part of their job. They are very skilled, working closely with patients, particularly dying patients, to assess their needs and have those very difficult, difficult and delicate conversations. Because at the moment, as the KCs say, we currently check for coercion in the cases where people have taken their own lives when someone is dead. This bill would make coercion a criminal offence with a sentence of up to 14 years. Surely by putting a legal framework around this really difficult situation, we will provide an extra level of safeguarding. Indeed, as one psychotherapist, who is terminally ill herself, said to me recently, coercion happens when things are hidden away. This bill would bring things out into the open. Surely that has to be safer for everyone. And let us look at what the absence of a robust legal framework looks like. I will give way.
Very grateful to the Honourable Lady for giving way and thank her for giving the House the time to debate this morning. She references coercion, and I understand the point that she makes about the two medics. But the medics won't be able to see or have heard anything and everything at all times. People will not be put beyond challenge because subsequent to the death, if a relative claims coercion of another relative, investigation will remain. I'm just entirely unclear how, without peradventure, two clinicians can claim that there has been no coercion at any point.
I mean, the right honourable member has kind of made the point for me there, in that, you know, we're going to check for coercion in a very robust system. We don't have any of that now. So at the moment, the person will definitely be dead. We have to look at the status quo by putting layers of safeguarding and checking for coercion. That's got to be better than the system that we've got now.
So that's MP Kim Ledbetter putting the case for this bill. I mean, what she's doing there, Chris, is having to defend herself, really, by people explaining, look, people can be coerced into saying, well, actually, you know, and actually they're in quite a vulnerable situation often when they're dying, into signing the bits of paper to say, you know, it's time to die.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what she's trying to say is that the idea is to try and put in place very strong, robust processes that try to prevent that. It's everything is an imperfect system, an imperfect world, right? And what we're seeing, trying to find there, I think, is a balance between the great suffering that we, you know, we claim it's humane when we put sort of suffering animals out of their misery, and yet it's not humane to potentially do that to someone who is clearly expressing their own free will. We allow those same people to make other decisions about their life, about their will and what they're giving to people, etc., etc., and we don't investigate coercion at that level for that sort of stuff. And what she's saying is this is probably an improvement, in fact, in some ways on that sort of system of looking for how are those vulnerable people in those end stages of their lives, what pressures are they having put on them. Like I say, I don't think that it's also, you know, whilst it's very difficult to sort of step back from these things, you know, it's not a one-way process that this is absolutely, once this bill goes ahead, that this progresses to everybody that's handicapped being sort of forced into assisted dying and things. And, you know, I think we, like I say, we just need to be a little bit careful in all these debates about what sort of views are being expressed and how extreme we are about things, and accept that views that we had sort of 50 years ago now have changed, and about all sorts of things in society, and we move on and we adapt as humans to what we see around us, and there's a lot of humanity in the thought process around this bill, and that's what it's trying to get at in a nice, safe, controlled manner, trying to take the extremes of political and religious thought out of it for better care for patients.
Yeah, but what about the finance? What about the money? Because Richard Burgeon, is it Martin? Bergen, Labour MP, because it's a free vote, they can vote whichever way they want, although they might get sacked if they vote the wrong way, of course. But we know how these things work on the ground, on the actual real level. He made an intervention about money. He's saying, well, actually, there is, because of the massive amounts of money that people are now having to pay for social care, particularly for the elderly, this is, you know, it is a form of coercion. Let's have a listen to him.
One thing that really concerns me is societal or systemic coercion. Elderly people in our society pay thousands of pounds per month at the moment to be in care homes. What reassurances can my honourable friend give me that a person, an elderly person in a care home who's been given 6 months to live, won't privately feel themselves, I'm a burden, I've been given 6 months to live. If I end my life now, I can save my family between £25,000 and £55,000. It really concerns me.
Well, again, as I've said already, at the moment we have no idea whether that person would take action, because we're not having those conversations. We're putting this out into the open, getting two medical professionals involved, getting a High Court judge involved, and actually evidence from other jurisdictions shows very clearly that coercion tends to happen the other way.
Yeah.
What tends to happen is families are saying to the person who might really, really feel that they want to take the choice of an assisted death, they try to stop them from doing it.
Yeah. Martin, the fact is that palliative care, hospices, funding for those who need nursing care, for example, in their elderly age, used to be something which was massively supported by the state. This is another casualty of Gordon Brown in 2008 and the bailout of the banks. Bit by bit, this care is gone. And so, of course, people are going to be concerned. I'm a burden on my family. They will get a five-figure sum if I say goodbye and bow out early.
Well, yes, I mean, that's an issue, but it's a separate issue from whether there should be assisted dying. I totally take that point. I think I'm with Chris on this, because in actual fact, in practice, in most hospitals which are dealing with this as they do every day, it's a bit messy, isn't it? I mean, you just don't, you know, lots of people, you could say, well, they could have another operation. Like my dad could have another operation. He's had cancer, bladder cancer. He's had three operations. Now, if it reappears, I do not think that anybody's going to say he's going to go back for another operation. It's a waste of time. And that, in a way, is assisted dying, if you see what I mean. Because you could say, we should spend
no,
that
no,
money.
No, it's not, is it? Just not having an op or not medicating someone, Chris, really, it's not quite the same, is it?
No, I mean, it's not entirely the same, but it's that decision process, isn't it, of saying, look, medically, there's nothing more that can be done for this person. What's left for them is palliative care. And whilst we can speak about the fact that we need palliative care services to be better and more available.
Morphine, basically, is it palliative care?
It's symptom control. About it, could it be pain control with all sorts of things? It can be, you know, if you happen to have tremors, we can give you medicines that stop things like that. But then at the very end of people's lives, you know, they are losing the ability to make any decisions about their own health once they've gone too far. And I think it's trying to identify clearly those people for whom the last few hours, days, weeks of their life,
months,
is truly intolerable. Well, they're setting this target, this thing of saying once you have a 6 month prognosis, obviously that's really quite hard to define for most people, apart from sort of, you know, cancer victims or people with things like Huntington's and stuff. But it's really the group of people it's really going to focus on, and that medics will focus on with this sort of thing, would be those people right towards the end stage of their life, when it's very clear for all to see they are asking for help to end their suffering, and we have the ability to do that. And like was said, the idea that there's going to be an outbreak of families trying to end the lives of their relatives, you know, before that stage because of money, it doesn't really add up. That people are, you know, people don't, the vast majority of people don't want to see the end of their mum and their dad or their brother, their sister, and their husband, their wife, their son, their daughter. They want them to live a good long life. They want to spend time with them as much as they can. There then comes a crossover moment where that time is no longer bearable for anybody because the suffering is so great, both for the patient and for the people observing it. And I think that's the group of patients that this really needs to focus on. Understanding all the concerns about the odd case here and there, that, you know, where the system can be abused. But it's about putting in place those robust checks and balances and trusting the profession that this can be done humanely.
Well, you're a professional. Have you had patients ask you to help them go over the edge?
I've never had a patient directly ask me themselves. I deal with emergency medicine, so most people that come in are that. I have dealt with multiple elderly people who have taken significant overdoses that have ended their life because of the pain they were in. Quite recently, in fact, an elderly gentleman who took a significant overdose of morphine to end his own life. We spent significant amounts of effort to stop that from happening, and in the end, everything was too much, and he did sadly pass away. But that was an elderly chap who had taken it upon himself because he was being let down by the rest of the system. His pain was too great, his suffering was great, and he took matters in his own hands. So I see that much more, and I think, you know, we can do better for those group of people in some way.
Well, I know one of the campaigns I was reading, I was quite sympathetic to their campaign banner, which was, we want assisted living, not assisted dying. So it would be nicer if your patient you were just talking about there had the help they needed. But that, of course, so much of that has gone. As we know, the NHS is in crisis. Anyway, let's finally, before we hear the last word from Chris Hook, Dr. Chris Hook, who's with us here in the studio, let's have a listen to Danny Kruger. He's a local MP, actually, in Devizes in Wiltshire here, who was setting out the case against this assisted dying bill. Let's have a little clip from him now.
The definition of terminal illness, which I'll come to, is in a sense the essential flaw in this bill, but I'll come on to that. Going back to this conversation that the patient has with the medical practitioner, the crucial thing is that the conversation doesn't need to be started by the patient, according to this bill. It can be started by the medic, by any medic, perhaps in hospital, who can make the suggestion of an assisted death to a patient who's never raised the issue themselves, whose family haven't suggested it, whose own doctor doesn't think it's the right thing to do. And so the idea is planted. And then for whatever reason, and by the way, there's no need ever to give a reason, the patient says they want to proceed with the assisted death. And so they sign a declaration, or rather somebody else can sign it for them, any professional, someone they don't know, maybe a new medical practitioner. Anyway, a total stranger can do all the paperwork on their behalf. That's what the section about the proxy entails. And then these two medical practitioners do their assessment. Happy to give way.
I'm very grateful to the Honourable Member for giving way. I would urge the Honourable Member to check the wording of the bill, because actually, if somebody signs as a proxy, they have to know the individual for 2 years, and they are simply signing to say that they agree with the patient who wishes to go forward with the assisted dying.
No time to check the bill, but my memory is that it says someone who knows the patient for 2 years, or someone of good standing in the community, which is some sort of professional who's not known to them at all. Anyway, someone could quickly check the bill, but my understanding is it could be a total stranger to them. So, we move on to the assessment, which these two practitioners do. Good work.
Isn't the matter very clear? Clause 15, subsection 5. In this section, proxy means a person who has known the person making the declaration personally for at least 2 years, or a person who is of good standing in the community. So there is no protection such as pretended by the supporters of this bill.
Well done, Daniel. Right, so the assessments have to determine
whether the patient is terminally ill, whether they have mental capacity to make the decision, and then whether they've been coerced or pressured into this, into the decision. So let's look at terminally ill. As I said, this, in many ways the whole question turns on this. I'm afraid this is a term of great elasticity, almost to the point of meaninglessness. It is well known, as the Honourable Gentleman said earlier, that it is impossible for doctors to predict with any accuracy that somebody will die within 6 months. It is a purely subjective judgment made in this case by a doctor whose job is approving assisted death. They simply have to determine for themselves, that not that it's reasonably certain that death will occur, but it can be reasonably expected. So basically, it's possible.
And I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, if you're interested, those two main speeches on the bill today, which passed its second reading. So this is very much likely to happen. But I mean, what he's suggesting there, Chris, is that, you've got people who are actually don't even know the one of the other things that I didn't put in that clip is that next of kin don't even need to be informed if someone is signing one of these. So what they're saying is that this is a pretty shoddy bit of legislation. Something needs to be done, but this is not it.
I mean, what that speech seemed to be suggesting is that there's a bunch of malign individuals of good standing running around in the community who are just going to go and start signing the death warrants of loads of people, and that's just simply not true. The people that that he's worried about are actually sort of criminals and out there anyway. And you know, the idea of families coercing people again is that point of those families will be coercing those patients into all sorts of horrible situations in the end of their life to save the money in other ways. I've seen patients linger on hospital wards for months and months and months because the family refused to sell a house because they want the inheritance, and that patient lives in a hospital ward completely uncared for and unvisited for many, many months. And so that's an intolerable situation. And I think, you know, the idea that there will suddenly be a group of medical practitioners out there who, for no evident benefit to themselves, will go around just telling people that it's probably time to die. And we know people who are severely depressed. One of the things we're trained to do is to ask them very clearly, have you considered suicide? And there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that for people who haven't considered suicide, raising the possibility that other people do that, doesn't make them suddenly go out and do it. So it would seem to me that would probably translate to a similar situation for people who are been given a terminal diagnosis at that stage. And if they feel that their quality of life is acceptable, I don't imagine there's suddenly going to be a whole swathe of people who just decide that, you know, for the sake of 20 grand here and there for their family, they're going to try and persuade a medical professional that it's time to end their life. And I don't believe that there'll be a whole group of people out there that, like I say, go around suggesting it to people inappropriately. Lots of very sensible things being said. It is very hard to determine precisely, you know, when someone is within 6 months of the end of their life with a terminal diagnosis. But like I say, I think the reality of what this is intending to do certainly is about trying to reach, when we reach that point where suffering is definitely outweighing the medical professional's ability to really help people anymore, that those people have the autonomy, they don't have to rely on their family, they have the medical autonomy not only to say I don't want any more treatment, but actually I want the ability to for this pain to stop, this suffering to stop, and I think for many people that would be a good thing. Let's see.
Well, one of the people in the, I think it was an MP, it must have been an MP, in this debate, I also overheard her saying, my daughter was given a 6-month diagnosis, she ended up living 35 years.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There are always, in every single situation, there will be absolute exceptional cases, right? Where we hear stories of miraculous cures and things, cancer suddenly vanishing, and perhaps the scan was actually wrong and stuff like that. And that's why there's all these robust the idea that there are robust checks and balances and stuff in order to stop this. And if someone is not in great distress and they do not wish to end their own life, there's not going to be this sudden swathe of pressure from medical professionals, from the NHS, and probably not from families either, for them to suddenly end their own
lives. It just seems a little bit strange to be adding to this sort of list of human rights out there that we're trying to champion. The right to suicide seems like slightly different. And as a role of a doctor, you know, this is a real big change, isn't it, surely, today? The doctors have never at least apart from people like Dr. Crippen and people in doctors in fiction and actually doctors who've been locked up, have never been surely doing this before, ever, in our... Well, it may be if you go back far enough, but this is quite a big change, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a huge change. I'm not saying that definitely it's 1,000%, you know, the right way for everything to go, but I think it is a big change. It's something that as medics, you know, you would have to really think about when you're getting involved with it and stuff. Yeah. And it's a big thing for the profession to take on and for the country to take on. But I think the most important thing is to have clear, sensible debate. Take out rhetoric from it. Take out the fact that we put such great weight on single, isolated, you know, cases that would have ended very differently if they had made a very strange decision comparatively for their actual condition, and talk about the reality of what this is trying to achieve, which is a more humane end to suffering for a small, specific group of patients for whom there is no other solution.
Okay, Dr. Chris Hook, thanks ever so much for joining us. Just before the break, we've got one final item, which is, thank you very much for whoever sent me this. It's I found it fascinating. We were talking with Joe a bit about homelessness in Bristol earlier on, and it's almost like from the sublime to the ridiculous, because here is this. It's done amazingly well on YouTube, but it's a look at people who are homeless in Bristol and living in caves.
Things have got so bad in Bristol, people have literally reverted back to the Stone Age and are now inhabiting caves.
You can see a shelter's been made over the top of where the fellow is sleeping. I'm literally in shock. I can't believe this. That things have got this bad for some people, that they're now having to live in caves. Up on the side of a cliff.
Honestly, I cannot believe that. Growing up on the outskirts of Bristol, there was always urban myths and urban legends of people that were living in the caves, but I just thought it was a myth. Honestly, I just thought it was a myth. To actually find these encampments is shocking. Truly shocking.
Yeah, so you were saying about the homeless situation in and around Bristol.
Yeah, it's basically, it's not as people think. It's actually more a system itself. People have this idea that the system sorts it all out and all the rest of it, but the fact is you can't get anything sorted at the minute. It's especially we're finding for British people, if you don't have an addiction or a health problem, or you can't be classified as having a mental health issue, you just don't get anything on the system. It's that simple.
So if you're not a drug addict or you're not suffering from mental health, you feel that there's basically real lack of
help. It's like a prerequisite to get your housing, and you get held down until such time as you agree with that, and that's, you know, and people think it's, oh well, that's the excuse for it. Yeah, there's a lot of people who, you know, have these issues, but there's loads of people out there that, you know, they're just turning up saying, well, I just want my money and stuff to get on with my life, and they're not being allowed. It's a bit sad, but yeah, the whole system, I mean, there's a lot of charities out there that are getting paid vast amounts of money.
Yeah.
And yet you look around, same people are on the streets.
Yeah.
So what's going on? Why is there no recirculation with people getting off the streets? You know, because you've got lots of charities using these people. Now, charities, a lot of them are good, especially the food charities and stuff like that, mm-hmm. that hand out clothes, showers, food. But when it comes to the charities getting people off the street, you know, it's almost like, you know, sorry, but you have to be an addict, or you have to have a disability, or you have to have a mental health illness, which is pretty insulting. People still think you can get job seekers, but you can't always, you know, you can't necessarily, it's almost impossible to get job seekers for a lot of people out in the streets anyway.
Yeah, well, you touched on the fact that without an address, you can't get a bank account, and then without the bank account, you can't then get the universal credit, the payment.
You can't have everybody, like, in the world who becomes homeless suddenly registered with some church, or, you know, is their address or a charity. I mean, yeah, some people do that, but the fact is you just shouldn't have to. We've got British society that says that it provides housing, provides a basic amount of money, and basically, unless you agree to be to have some sort of addiction or something, you don't get that.
Yeah.
So that's when you look at everybody around, it's just stagnant. The big charities that are supposed to be helping people off the street, they've sat with me and and they've said, oh well, have you got this, have you got that? Of course I haven't got these documents, or of course I haven't got these things.
Yeah.
You know, I even went into HSBC. I said, right, you've got a homeless bank account, can I get one? And they said, yeah, but you need an address. I was like, well, what are you on about? You
know? Hold on.
I'm not quite sure of the guy's name, but anyway, that was an interview in the caves. I think it's down in the Avon Gorge, Martin. This is, I suppose, the side effect of the rack renting system we've got now. I mean, we were hearing about street homeless earlier on going up and up and up, you know, roughly something like an extra 30% every year for the last 3 years here in Bristol, the people who are sleeping on the streets. But for many like him, you know, they just see that so much of their money is going in rent that they've got to find somewhere that's just not going to be costing them that, whether it's in a caravan, whether it's in a doorway or whatever. They need the money. They can't afford the rent.
Well, that's right, because the rents in Bristol are the second highest in the country after London. And, you know, people who are, what people, and of course the other thing is that the housing component of universal credit doesn't keep pace with the increase in rents. We've had massive increases in rents. I've had three rent increases in 3 years. But the amount that is allocated by universal credit for that is way lower than the actual rent. So loads of people, this is why people go to food banks. So they get their universal credit. You've got to keep a roof over your head. So you pay the rent and then you've got no money for food, which is why people end up going to food banks. And of course, this is intensifying. And of course, if the economy goes down the drain, as it might, it's flatlining at the moment, then all of this is just going to explode. And of course, as I say, if the housing market goes down, all the private rented tenants like me will be booted out because everybody want to sell the house and they want to sell it with vacant possession. And that's perfectly, you know, that's perfectly legitimate for the owners to do that, and they can kick you out. And that's what they did to me last time. And I expect that's what will happen next time.
Okay, well, after the break, a look at this week's fascinating chat with those people who, it was an online chat, and I'll put a link up to on our show page, of course, at thisweek.org.uk, about those who have been arrested for supporting Palestinians.
Show. my legs, I can hardly stand.
See my legs, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my face, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my legs, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my face, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my legs, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my face, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my legs, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my face, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my legs, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my face, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my legs, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my face, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my legs, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my face, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my legs, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my face, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my legs, I can hardly stand. I believe you can make me well. See my face, I can hardly stand.
Well, if you weren't schizoid before, you are now. 1968 King Crimson, 21st century schizoid man. Just as an aside, because I load up onto our YouTube channel the show usually on a Monday with a few pickies in it and slides. And I've never had before a ban all over the world for using Moonchild, as I did a few weeks ago. So you have to kind of persuade YouTube, coax it and press a little button to make it replace it with some innocuous nonsense music in order to allow anyone to see it. So I would suggest it's probably the record company of King Crimson, whoever they owns their rights, are being particularly... Well, they don't want people using that music in films and things like that or whatever. So that's a good reason, of course, to do it. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Before the King Crimson was from around about the same period, 1970, The Temple, it's from Jesus Christ Superstar. And Martin, we're going to be starting part two by looking at the this brilliant conversation, which was set up by I know not whom, but it included loads of the people who have been arrested, talking about their experiences, and also looking at all of the politics behind it. I mean, I hope we've done our job by taking a bit of a look at Matt Jukes, the guy who's in charge of this anti-terror squad, who turn up in balaclavas and bash up and handcuff and steal private contacts of journalists and other people who've been supporting Palestinians.
Well, I mean, it's I have seen this reported briefly in The Guardian, but other than that, the mainstream media have ignored completely these attacks on journalists who are trying to cover what's going on in Palestine. And of course, we've also been, you know, at the same time, the Daily Telegraph have been bloviating away about Alison Pearson being bullied by the police because of her tweet about Jew-hating Muslims. So, in other words, this is below the radar for most people. So, it's really rather important.
Well, I think it's a bit annoying to hear you scoring these little political points here. I mean, really, whatever side of the debate you're on, you shouldn't be being arrested for having an opinion.
No, but what is interesting is that nobody knows, if they're watching the mainstream media, that these journalists have been bullied. They just don't know about it. If they don't know about it, they can't say anything about it. And of course, that's what they do. They're silencing people they don't agree with. And, you know, meanwhile, the people are going on about the woke brigade are trying to stop me talking. She's been in favour of suppressing all protests. Alison Pearson doesn't want us to be allowed to protest about Palestine. That's how much in favour of free speech she is.
Well, she's not, is she? Anyway, the event was kicked off by Andrew Feinstein, who, to my knowledge, hasn't been arrested, but he's got a very good... He's quite an interesting character, Martin, isn't he? Because he's followed the whole... trajectory through the ANC in South Africa as a friend of Nelson Mandela and a big supporter of him through the 1980s, right now to being over in the UK and supporting the Palestinians. I mean, he sees the two issues as very closely connected, as we did the other week, chatting with Anne Lemon and Isaac Kneebone Hopkins, who are both were involved back in the day in the 1980s, as Anne was in setting up the St. Paul's Apartheid Free Zone, and Isaac now is in the present boycott of Israeli goods.
Yes, well, I mean, Andrew Feinstein, if you remember, he came on this show years ago when he wrote the book about the arms trade, because he hadn't talked about that, didn't he?
Well, more recently, he was on just after the Gaza genocide started, talking about that too.
Well, I mean, he's an admirable person, and of course, he took a massive chunk of Keir Starmer's vote in Islington, I think it is, where he was, he stood against him and did very creditably.
Yeah, so let's have a listen to Andrew now, his take on this present genocide and apartheid by the Israelis compared to his experience in South Africa, where they successfully overturned it.
All of those who struggled against apartheid, who led the liberation movement against apartheid in South Africa, were described as terrorists. Most infamously, my former boss, Nelson Mandela. Margaret Thatcher did not only describe him as a terrorist and a communist, but also suggested privately to the apartheid regime that they should organize his killing in prison, as it was too dangerous to keep him alive because he was becoming a symbol of everything that they stood against. In other words, actual democracy, actual freedom, actual liberation. So I know it is little solace, but it is worth reminding ourselves that what you are suffering is what many other incredibly courageous, committed people have suffered throughout the ages. We should also not forget that Margaret Thatcher, after advising the South African apartheid state to somehow organize Mandela's death, and there was a wonderful anecdote that Mandela told of after his release, when he came to Britain, he spoke at the Great Hall in Westminster long before he was our country's president. And Mrs. Thatcher, who had retired, was there and sort of hobbled up to him on her Zimmer frame. And Mandela gave her a big smile and said to her, "You must be surprised to see me here." And she looked confused. And he said, "Well, after all, you advised them to murder me." And for once in her life, she was speechless. But we shouldn't forget that she described as her greatest political achievement Tony Blair. Because she had effectively turned the Labour Party into a neoliberal warmongering party and Tony Blair into a war profiteer who has made, in my very conservative calculation, in excess of £110 million personally from the companies who profited from the invasion of Iraq and from British arms companies like BAE Systems. And for my sins, which are clearly many, I live in the constituency of the bastard son of Tony Blair, Keir Starmer. Now, for those of us who've been subject to this appalling human being for almost 10 years as our Member of Parliament, we know from personal experience that his every instinct is anti-democratic and authoritarian. And of course, this started before he became an active politician. In his time as the Director of Public Prosecutions at the Crown Prosecution Service, he never once allowed the prosecution of an agent of the British state, be it police personnel who were involved in the killing of protesters or British military personnel involved in the murder of innocents in various parts of the world. It is therefore no surprise to us that as soon as he came to power in Britain, something he's been planning for decades, one of the first things he would do is ensure that anti-terror legislation is utilized against everything that could challenge his political project. And what is his political project? It is a project to enrich and empower the billionaires who have funded his political rise and funded his political party and his corporate sponsors. Let us not forget that at the Labour Party conference in Liverpool, one of the biggest sponsors of events at that conference was none other than BAE Systems.
So we've heard a lot of last week about BlackRock, Martin. Here, this a little bit more about the arms companies. They are an incredibly powerful lobby, the private equity firms with arms companies, which, of course, they are massively invested in. They are this kind of amazing monopoly machine, which Harley Schlanger was explaining to us last week, which allows the... rather wonderful little BlackRock, the Conspiracies You Don't Know documentary, where they're invested in everywhere in an industry. So they don't need to have a monopoly. They've got shares in all the companies in that industry, and that includes arms.
Well, arms also is not really a free market at all, is it? I mean, the governments determine what arms they want, and then, of course, you get, once you're a supplier, they can't just change the supplier. We could perhaps get the Chinese in to compete with the BAE Systems, couldn't we? They could probably knock out missiles half the price. But, of course, you can't do that because the Chinese are the enemy. So, therefore, if you are BAE Systems, which used to, of course, belong to the government, doesn't anymore. And, of course, this is a big difference between the way we do things and the way the Russians do things. Their military-industrial complex is a not-for-profit nationalised industry, which is why it gets the job done, whereas we spend a lot of money on killing people, but we don't actually get any kit that's any use to us.
You know, I can hear, or I can see in the corner of the room looking down on us is Michael Hudson here. I mean, he would suggest, wouldn't he, that the Ukraine war, particularly, possibly with Gaza too, is actually what's really going on is a battle between different systems. The finance capitalist, neoliberal dream, which is for people who are rich with money to control and buy everything.
Well, that's right. And of course, at one stage after the fall of the Berlin Wall and before China really got going after being let into the World Trade Organization, the US was a dominant power. Francis Fukuyama famously wrote the book, The End of History, The Last Man and the End of History. And of course, at that point, they could get away with everything. They could carry on profiteering. They could knock countries, you know, third world countries, throw them against the wall, like they did in Iraq and Libya, Syria, Afghanistan. But now, of course, they're up against peer competitors who don't do it that way. The Russians had their experience with finance capitalism in the 1990s, and they ain't going back there. And that's why they, you know, the sanctions on Russia have been so ineffectual, because they've basically reorganized their system without Western finance.
Anyway, another speaker at this brilliant meeting, I keep raging about it, but it was fascinating to hear everyone sort of pooling their knowledge about how disgusting the Gestapo anti-terror police under Matt Dukes are becoming in Britain here. Another person who spoke who was... I believe detained, certainly he was raided, is Tony Greenstein, who's a regular contributor to this programme and has his own blog, the first Jew to be expelled from the Labour Party, and also one of the founders of the Modern Palestine Solidarity Campaign.
When we come to the question of genocide, we have a law which is quite clear, the International Criminal Court Act of 2001, which makes participation in or aiding or being ancillary to a genocide a criminal offence. But of course, the police have shown absolutely no interest in implementing that law, because if they did, they would have to feel the collar of Keir Starmer and his associates. And Keir Starmer has been consistent in his denial that there is a genocide taking place in Palestine. Indeed, he's encouraged that genocide by saying that Israel has every right to withhold food, water, medicine, fuel, and so on. And Starmer came to power in the Labour Party, promising to root out anti-Semitism. Well, we know what that was about. But if you deny genocide when it's taking place in Palestine before our very eyes, and there's no need to give examples here today of that, the destruction of universities, hospitals, the shooting of children and those who try to rescue them, etc., then Starmer is absolutely no different from those who deny the Nazi Holocaust. Starmer is a Holocaust denier. And we've seen the trashing of international law in the process, as the police see their job as harassing and intimidating Palestine solidarity activists and not just Palestine Action, but really anyone who is involved in the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And they've done this using an obscure clause, Section 12.1a of the Terrorism Act 2000. And what does that act say? It says anyone expressing an opinion or belief that is supportive of a proscribed organization, and in doing so is reckless as to whether a person to whom the expression is directed will be encouraged to support a proscribed organization. The second leg of that is virtually impossible to define. How would you know when you express an opinion or belief what the effect will be on other people? But the act, or the clause, which was inserted by the Counterterrorism Act 2021, makes it quite clear that what it's criminalizing is an expression of opinion or belief. In other words, it has absolutely nothing to do with terrorism. And it goes on to say that is supportive of a proscribed organization. In other words, what you say about, for example, Hamas or Hezbollah may indeed be true. But if it's supportive of them, then you are still guilty of a criminal offense. In other words, expressing a truth is in itself criminal. And I just want to take a quick look at the definition of terrorism, because that is the basis on which organizations are proscribed. And it says in Section 1B, the use or threat is designed to influence the government. Well, Hamas has no government. Israel is in the illegal occupation of the Gaza Strip, and the International Court of Justice has just ruled to that effect. There is no legitimate government. So how can they be a terrorist organization? And that is really the nonsense that we are facing.
So it's Tony Greenstein there. I'll put a link up to the full interview. In fact, it's not an interview. It's a discussion panel, a really excellent one, looking at the tactics of Matt Dukes's Gestapo in grabbing people who are simply either stating the truth or trying to stop genocide, Martin.
Well, that's right. And, don't forget that we've passed these laws in this country now where our own police, intelligence services and army can act, they can break the law with impunity. The government decides, with no debate in Parliament, that Hezbollah and Hamas are terrorist organisations, including the political wings of both organisations.
As well as the Islamic Revolutionary Guard in Iran. I mean, this is basically a part of their armed forces.
That's right. And of course, the popular mobilization units in Iraq are part of the Iraqi armed forces.
What about the Yemenis? Are they supposed to be terrorists too?
Well, but the Yemeni National Army was split, and of course, well, I mean, we are already, as you know, Tony, we've been bombing Yemen, but the Yemenis are fighting back. It's their country. We're bombing them. Maybe they'd be.
What are you going to say? That maybe they should what?
They would be within their rights to attack British bases in Britain or Akrotiri, where we're flying from Akrotiri in Cyprus.
Well, it's almost by attacking them. We're asking for that, aren't we?
Well, we are. We're doing the same with Russia as we discussed.
We're daring them.
That's right. I mean, but they have been trying to sink British ships. You know, they're trying to kill British sailors, as is their right.
So what is the motivation for all this? What's in it for us?
Us sitting in this room, or the British
for
establishment?
For the British establishment, for the British government, for Starmer, and for the Foreign Office.
I think the
Ministry of Defence.
The default position of the British establishment in this country is to do whatever the Americans want us to do. That's what it's about. And Starmer himself is really clear about this. We're not going to do anything that the Americans don't like. And of course, he said yesterday that Hamas and Hezbollah are terrorist organizations. There's no moral equivalence between them and the Israelis. I just point out the Israelis have killed a hell of a lot more people than Hamas and Hezbollah, but they're not terrorists, apparently. But there you go. Israel is a terrorist state. I mean, ultimately, you know, if they're going to have rule of law, all of their people should be prosecuted. Some of them should probably hang. Many of them should go to prison. That's not what's going to happen. But it is the Hezbollah, the Israeli occupation forces are the direct descendants of the terrorists that used to kill British soldiers back in
now,
the day.
Now, Sarah Wilkinson is not the sort of person you would normally expect to see as a terrorist. She does not have a balaclava, as far as I know. She doesn't have a gun. What's going? Why does it? It is that she has to be raided by the anti-terror squad, Martin. We're going to hear from her in a second.
Well, what they're doing with all these raids is they're trying to intimidate.
Well, she was arrested, wasn't she?
They're trying to intimidate the people who are, you know, who are basically spreading the news about what's the genocide in Palestine. And they've not taken any of these people to court, even though they've been harassing them, because I think it would be quite likely if you put them in front of a jury, you might have to have diplock courts like you said in Northern Ireland with no jury. But if you put them in front of a jury, the jury's going to say, well, that's just an expression
of
opinion.
Well, Matt Jukes is not a police officer. He's a man of lawlessness. He's saying, I'm going to raid you and I dare you to sue us and get compensation in court. Although I would imagine quite a lot of these people who have been raided and arrested will successfully sue Matt Jukes for wrongful arrest. And this is, by the way, the guy who's in charge of the anti-terror branch of the Metropolitan Police, who for many years were harbouring rapists and murderers amongst their police ranks.
Well, I mean, it's definitely a step towards a police state. And you'd have thought that all of these people, you know, on GB News and everything going on about the expression of freedom of speech, they ought to be, if they're consistent, they ought to be picking these causes up. But they're not.
Well, we are. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to Sarah speaking about her raid on her home and subsequent arrest by Matt Jukes' little Gestapo boys.
I think probably most people have heard the story, but so I'll condense it down as much as I can. Sort of very similar to Natalie, it's sort of 7:10. There's a knock on the door. And the minute I opened it, we've got 16 balaclavaed huge men in the house with no identification. There's no way to authenticate if they are who they say they are. They just say they're anti-terror squad. They had a warrant but refused to show it. They were quite violent. They pushed my son up against the wall. And then frog marched me up the stairs, didn't allow me to get dressed, didn't allow me to put my shoes on, handcuffed me so tightly that it cut my wrists, didn't allow me to take any medication for my Crohn's, and then threw me into a van, which then promptly, in the back of the van, I realized not being able to get ID or authenticate that these were police, that this was an execution. We drove the wrong way, about an hour. Drive towards a different county. Now I knew where we were going or where we were supposed to be going. So the fact that we were driving into the woods, if you like, I think was done to scare me, was done deliberately. These are local, officers, if you like. I don't actually know what to call them. So they know the route. They had a sat nav. There was no excuse for going the wrong way, but they went the wrong way by about an hour's worth of driving. So yes, there was an hour of thinking, okay, I'm going to die at this point. But while I was in custody, which was about 12 to 14 hours, same as Natalie, they absolutely ransacked the house, desecrated my mother's ashes, knelt in them, scattered them everywhere, stole and looted about £400 in money. They took my passport, but didn't list it. So part of my bail conditions were that I surrender my passport in 5 days, which I couldn't surrender because they'd taken it but denied that they had it. So this created another issue. But, you know, I hadn't been able to get dressed. I got no shoes. I got no meds. So I had no food. I had nothing to drink for the whole time that I was in custody, which is, you know, you're dehydrating and you can't sleep, obviously, because you're very wired and very rattled. But the house was absolutely ransacked. And it took 7 people and about 5 days to piece by piece put the house back together again. And it was only then that we realized that bank cards were missing, keys were missing. I have a disabled key for the disabled toilets. That's missing. My Crohn's card's missing. My medication was missing. Books autographed by the authors are missing. They've seemed to maliciously taken books that were signed, pictures from the wall. And I can't claim any of these things back because none of them are listed. So all of this stuff is gone. All of these precious items, I can't I can't ask for back ever because they haven't taken them as far as their evidence is concerned.
Well, don't trust the police's evidence, Sarah. Martin, I mean, they sound like a bunch of thugs that should be arrested themselves rather than the police turning up and knocking on her door at 7:10.
Yes, and of course, it's we're paying for this, you know. We've got no money for dentistry. We can afford... We've got no money to fix potholes in the road. They've knocked down Trinity Road Police Station because there weren't enough police station policemen to run it. But meanwhile, we're paying these people to go and kick people's doors down and act, you know, and essentially as intimidators. As you say, they should probably be arrested themselves and punished. But that's not going to happen, is it?
Well, another journalist that's been arrested recently, well, I say recently, it was actually 2 years ago. So it's not just to do with Gaza and Palestine. It does seem we've got an increasing kind of Gestapo-style police state. And you may remember we reported, Martin, about the Extinction Rebellion protest on the M25, where they shut the M25 down by climbing onto the gantries. And, you know, sort of basically scaling the gantries, putting their banners up on the gantry, and then the police are forced to close the motorway. And they get a lot of attention for doing this. But the journalists that were reporting this were arrested. Do you remember? I don't know if you remember that.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, so those cases have been chugging their way through the courts. And I'm really happy to say that I had a chat last week with one of those journalists who was arrested and is now well on the way to feeling rather, you know, vindicated, getting his money back, basically. So, I mean, this is the principle, Martin, here is basically to do with the freedom of the press, isn't it? That the police are not there to arrest people taking photographs; they are there to arrest the people up on the gantry.
Well, yes, but they interpreted it as they were going to get the people who were taking the photographs and being journalists. And the other thing, of course, that's been dragging on outside of mainstream notice is the Spy Cops investigation. And that's, or we paid for that as well. You know, policemen going around pretending to be animal rights protesters, giving people babies and then disappearing. People used to say that, you know, the GDR, you know, the German Democratic Republic was a sort of controlled police state. Well, you know, what goes on in this country? Are we that far away from the Stasi here? I don't think we are we?
Well, Martin, I love you sometimes because you come up with an excuse to play a clip that has been sitting there for a couple of weeks now, which is actually with one of these spy cops.
The spy cops scandal has certainly, with some pockets of the population, has made them aware of what's going on. And it has horrified many people, but in my view, it's not horrified enough people. It's not held the headlines anywhere near as much as it should do. Now, obviously, we have this inquiry going on, the Mitting inquiry, which theoretically should be adequately studying what's happened and asking the right questions as to who directed these police organisations to spy on people and for what reasons. But I don't have any faith in the Mitting inquiry. I'm afraid I remain pessimistic. While the inquiry's been going on, the government has quite happily been putting in legislation which would counter many of the potential conclusions that the inquiry could come to. And specifically, I'm referring to the CHIS Act, the Covert Human Intelligence Source Act, which many of us, including Big Brother Watch, campaigned against when it was still the CHIS bill. That act essentially preempts some of the most sinister aspects of the Spy Cops scandal by actually making the activity of both police undercovers, undercover police, and police informants as to be protected by law, so that if you commit a crime during the operation, you can be exonerated, you are immune from prosecution. And it's not just the legislation, it's also the psychological impact to every undercover police officer and government spy in the shape of an informant. It's a big difference, trust me, to know that you have that immunity enshrined in law.
Do you think, from your experience before, that the system worked well enough that the CPS could only prosecute where there was public interest to do so, and actually, for the most part, the system worked fairly. Do you think that's a reasonable thing to suggest?
Yeah, the suggestion that the system before the Act was better than the system now. Now, let me put it this way. Let me put it into context for people in a really simple way to make people understand just how powerful undercover police and informants are. If a police officer wants to search your house, they need a search warrant. In order to get that search warrant, they need to provide really credible information, bits of evidence, to convince a police inspector that they should be allowed to apply for a search warrant. The inspector will agree after asking certain questions. The police officer will then have to go and speak to a magistrate's clerk and convince the magistrate's clerk that they have enough information to justify the rather serious deed of searching someone's house without their consent. If the magistrate's clerk agrees, you will then go to the magistrate, who will ask their own questions, and if they agree, you then have your document, which means that you can go into someone's house without their consent and search through their most private things. That's judicial oversight, an important piece of judicial oversight. If the police want to enter your life as an undercover operative or send a police informant into your life to find out your most private things and your most private thoughts even, there's no judicial oversight. All of that is decided in-house. All of that, that management of that is decided in-house. There is no judicial oversight at all. And I would argue that the most intrusive thing the government can do is to send an agent into your life. I was good at what I did because I am incredibly manipulative. I have the skills to manipulate individuals and whole social groups around me. I knew I was good at that, and I reveled in developing those skills. I can make people jump to my tune. I can have people in the palm of my hand. And there was no judicial oversight for my actions.
So that's Neil Woods, former spy cop there. Martin, he sounds like a poacher. Oh, well, maybe maybe more gamekeeper turned poacher. He thinks that the job that he had to do was absolutely wrong and disgusting.
Well, it's good that he's speaking out.
That's on Big Brother Watch, by the way. I'll put a link up to that on our show page, the full interview at thisweek.org.uk.
But, of course, you know, what the effect of all of this is, the exposure of the spy cops, the harassment of pro-Palestinian journalists and so on, is that people who are involved in the movement, what I call our movement, this great movement of ours, everybody just creates an atmosphere of fear and suspicion. And also, of course, lots of people, when they see, you know, some people are inspired when they see people being persecuted, they think, oh, I'm going to step forward and defend them. Others just think, I'm going to give this a wide berth. And if you've got a family and you've got relatives that you want to protect and so on, people will walk away from activism, and that's the whole point of it. We just make the cost of being involved in any of these things, animal rights, Extinction Rebellion, pro-Palestinian, whatever it is, we're just going to make your life a misery until you give up. That's what the bottom line is.
Isn't this is a bit of a fascist system where actually the only people that really get to call the shots are big companies with the big lobbies, like we were hearing earlier. Your finance people, your Black Rocks, and your arms industry.
That's right, and also the intelligence securocrats who are basically. I talked last week about Project Alchemy. Which Clarenberg has got loads of documents for that. They basically spend an awful lot of time trying to bully British public opinion in favour of war with Russia and against sanctions on Israel. And we're paying for these people to do this. How can you claim to live in a democracy where the secret services basically have a budget for trying to bombard you with propaganda and to take out people they don't like to get the results they want? And that's the society we live in.
Anyway, let's go to Tim off that little diversion down the spy cops route, which I think is an absolutely fascinating and very valid one, Martin. Thank you. Let's have a listen now to Tom Bowles. He's a national press photographer. He works as a freelancer, but he'd be selling pictures to most of the national newspapers. He was down at this Just Stop Oil protest in Hertfordshire on the M25, just as the Just Stop Oil people managed to scale the gantry and the police arrived to stop all the traffic. He was the subject of the police spotted him taking his pictures there, and they decided, right, we're going to shut this guy down.
I photographed them on the carriageway, and I could, because all traffic has stopped, it's very quiet and peaceful, and I could hear the officer saying to the to the policeman, detain those two. There was a filmmaker who was up on the bridge with me at the same time, who happened to be there at the same time. We weren't together. And I heard the police officer point at us two and say, detain those two. And I thought, ah, a bit odd, so carried on taking pictures.
Okay, could, maybe at this point, sorry to stop you telling the tale, but I mean, can you just give us, explain, you know, is it an agency you're filing to, a picture desk? How are you getting the pictures from your camera to the press?
Well, I send them to the I'm sending these ones to a small agency called Story Picture Agency, who I worked with a bit, but I send them straight from the camera to either the picture desk or a small agency. So as the police arrive, I've pre-captioned the images, so a protest, and then I can update it on my phone, so I can say, you know, police arrive at scene of Hertfordshire Just Stop Oil, you know. And then,
so is this, sorry, but is this going straight from your camera out on sort of through the mobile data network?
Yes, so straight from my camera straight to a picture desk or an agency. So it takes a matter of seconds to get there. So it's immediate. It's immediate news. That sort of immediate news is now, you know, the rolling news is really important. So the Daily Mail are the biggest users of content or for immediate news. And then from that, then you'll get the Sun using some bits, the Times, the Telegraph, and then it works its way down, the Mirror, the Express. They'll have online content as well that they'll take from freelance journalists at a push. You know, they like to have it from an agency because it's cheaper, but they will take it from freelance journalists who have something that's exclusive, basically.
Anyway, so sorry to go off on a tangent, but you've just got the police walking towards you, and you overheard them saying, detain those two.
Yeah, which is not the usual sort of thing that I expect to hear. You know, it might be find out what those two are doing, go and speak to those two, something like that. But so as the police officer walked towards me, because he had to walk up the embankment and then along the bridge, I said, good morning, officer, in the way that I always do. Whilst still taking pictures, and while I'm taking pictures, I'm also filing, so I don't have to look at the back of the camera. I can send them from the viewfinder, basically. And he just said, secure your camera, which was a bizarre statement. Didn't say anything else. Secure your camera, secure your camera. And I said, what's that? And then he grabbed my arm and put a handcuff on it. And I was slightly shocked because I'm not doing anything illegal. I'm very, very definitely within the law with what I'm doing. And I'm quite happy to have a conversation with the police officer and show him a press card. And I'm quite happy to explain why I'm there. But I don't expect to be put in handcuffs.
He's not even been read his rights. This inspector has sent this copper up there to say detain this guy, and he's just come straight up to him, puts handcuffs on him.
Well, that's right. So, in other words, they break their own rules, and then we're expected to obey whatever rules they come up with, but they don't stick to the rules that they're supposedly enforcing.
I mean, the actual effect of this, of course, is, which I do talk to Tim about, in the longer interview, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. In fact, I will do a YouTube of it too, because he sent me a couple of photographs that he'd actually taken whilst in handcuffs and sent to the picture agency whilst in handcuffs, because he could still actually hold his camera even though he had the handcuffs on. So he's click 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 sending photographs, including photographs of, you know, bits of a policeman, and I suppose this immediately tells the people at the picture desk, crikey, look, we've got a picture of a copper here, so they can put that in the paper. But they seem to be, the effect of this, Martin, is basically to shut the coverage down, isn't it? It's not the any other reason that they don't want this reported. The police, they're finding it embarrassing, and I suppose ultimately the idea is to try and stop copycat things.
Yes, I mean, the Tory government was particularly keen on this with this, you know, their bill of, you know, increased police powers to stop protesters from doing things. And the reason they're trying to stop this is because they, you know, they don't like the possibility that we're going to question what they do, and they're doing everything they possibly can to prevent us from doing it.
There have been some very steep sentences for things like the guy that scaled the bridge over the Dartford crossing, for example. And for these people who went onto these gantries, I think back in the day, if you were to go back, even 10 or 20 years, this sort of thing was, seen as civil disobedience, but it certainly wasn't some sort of massive offence. What you're doing is you're slowing down the traffic, you're stopping the traffic, or whatever, but you're not, and in a way, the actual Just Stop Oil protests themselves were kind of counterproductive. You know, what you're doing is you're targeting the people who are actually the victims of the government's transport policy. They got very little. It's not as if all these people have chosen to be in their cars. Many of them just can't afford to use other methods of public transport. So there's an element of lack of wisdom of this protest. But that's no excuse for the police to go and handcuff poor old Tom, who stood there just doing his job.
Well, that's right. I mean, freedom of speech ultimately means freedom of speech for people you don't agree with. Otherwise, it doesn't mean anything at all, does it? And I think this is the issue here. And there is definitely a concerted attempt by, I mean, this project, Alchemy, which people can read about it on the Grey Zone, the guy in charge of it, General Chris, what is his name? It'll come to me in a minute. I can't remember all the names of everybody, but it's got names. You know, we know who these people are, and they're plotting away on email about how we can bamboozle the British public into supporting a war with Russia. How can we take down people who are critical of this policy? And it's all, you know, this is they're working away behind
Chris Shepherd, is it?
No, it's not Shepherd. It begins with S, but I can't remember it offhand now. Right. People can look it up on the Grey Zone, because I'd never heard of him before either. But he seems to be a principal involved in all of this. He's not Brigadier Gordon Kerr. I can remember his name. He was in charge of the Force Research Unit. But, I mean, we've got major generals now who are spending most of their time cooking up what you might call media campaigns and harassment campaigns. So media campaigns to push what they want, and harassment campaigns against people they don't like who are questioning what they're doing. And you know, David Miller, who we've had in here, I mean, Paul Mason was working with MI6 officers to try and discredit David Miller as a this, that and the other because of his position on the Ukraine. So in other words, we've got a secret police in this country. Of course we have. We've always had one, and it's still there.
So let's have a listen to the second part from of our longer interview, where Tom just takes us through what happened that day and subsequently. This is the day he was arrested, and this is from a few days later. He'd managed to locate a lawyer. He was just on his way to see his lawyer when he gets a call from the Hertfordshire Chief Constable.
The photographer's community was great. I got a phone call from someone who had been dealt, you know, badly by the police and was suing them. And he phoned up straight away. I had like hundreds of phone calls straight away. And he phoned up and said, I'm using this firm of solicitors. They deal with police misconduct. So I'd recommend them. So it was a company called Bat Murphy. So I phoned up Bat Murphy and said, would you represent me? And this is what's happened. And on my way to my first meeting with them, I had a phone call from an unknown number, and it happened to be the Chief Constable of Hertfordshire Police, making a full apology to me about what had happened. This was a few days after. the arrest. And he made this full apology. And at the end of it, I said, I'm sorry, I can't hear you. The phone's broken up. I don't know who it is. You'll have to phone back in half an hour. And I hung up because I wasn't prepared to have an important phone call like that out of the blue when I'm walking along. You know, if you're a person in that much power, you arrange, you know, I couldn't just phone him up and ask a question. And I didn't expect that he should just feel that he could phone me up out of the blue.
No, it sounds like he's trying to butter you up.
Yeah, but he wasn't expecting me to do that, obviously. And then I just walked straight into the lawyers. And the first meeting I had with Molly Cox, my lawyer, was, hi, the phone's going to go. It's going to be the Chief Constable of Hertfordshire Police making a full apology. And she said, no, that's what we're aiming for. And I said, no, he's. I've just hung up on him. He's going to phone back. And he phoned up and she took notes and she said, that's never happened before. Because I hadn't employed her, I didn't let him know that she was there. She just took notes on it. And I sort of said, you know, we need to have a meeting afterwards. We need to, you know, you need to make sure your police are trained properly so that this doesn't happen again. I don't accept this apology as like the end of it. You know, I appreciate you making the time to phone me, but I've gone through hell.
So that's Tom Bowles. He had a horrific time. And longer interview on thisweek.org.uk. But very great presence of mind to get the Chief Constable to phone him back whilst the lawyer was sitting there able to make notes. And if you go on to Bat Murphy's website, you will find his lawyer has put a great little statement there about Hertfordshire Police admitting breaching human rights of journalists arrested at protest. Tom Bowles, professional photographer, was arrested whilst photographing Just Stop Oil by officers untrained in the important role of the media at protest. Well, that's what they always say, Martin, isn't it? They knew exactly who he was, what they were doing, and what they were doing was wrong, but they didn't care because they knew the public would pay.
Well, that's right. And of course, you know, even if the attitude be, if we've been overzealous here and we've overstepped the mark, that what we've actually succeeded in doing is intimidating everybody concerned, the people in the protest, people taking photographs of the protest. You know, we really want to send a very strong message to these people. Don't forget, you know, the Tories were still in power at that stage, and they were bloviating about the need to send people to prison and punish them for disrupting our lives. You know, these terrible protesters that disrupt our lives, and these hate marches. They're having hate marches right through central London every weekend. Hate marches. And
again, he had his house searched by the police. You see, yeah. this is the sort of thing they do.
Yeah.
Quite. I mean, it seems to me that a lot of this is to gather information about who he's talking to, his contacts.
That's right.
Who he might know, maybe in Just Stop Oil. So this is a phishing operation, effectively,
yeah.
Which of course is in itself is criminal. The police are not allowed yeah. to just visit people to do phishing operations to find out a little bit more about Just Stop Oil.
Yeah, well, I think back to the years ago when we set up Stop the War Bristol, and I can't remember who it was. We had a whole list of people, you know, email addresses, telephone numbers. We're gradually, you know, collecting the people that we were going to be a part of our group and make contact with them. And she left the list in her car, parked in a multi-storey car park in Bristol, and she came back to find the car had been broken into, and the only thing taken was that list. Because presumably that's taken away by MI5 or whoever. They go through it and they put it all on their files.
It might have been taken by a homeless person who just needed it to start a fire.
Possibly.
But maybe not. Okay, Martin, well, that's all for this week. We haven't really talked about MI5. Maybe we should just mention that briefly before we go. Manchester Arena, the families are really upset that the MI5 apparently are above the law.
Well, I mean, I mean, without a clip, I don't really know what it is they're alleging. But of course, you know, there's lots of suspicions around what happened in Manchester Arena.
It's not so much that; it's that the families were suing MI5 because they had information which, if they'd acted on it, would have stopped their loved ones dying. MI5 have been declared by the High Court to be above the law. Basically, there's no way this prosecution can take place.
Well, I mean, what is very suspicious is that a Libyan Islamic fighting group, their headquarters outside Libya, which was basically in Tripoli, their headquarters outside Libya was Manchester. And they've been working with MI6 for years and years and years in attempts to overthrow Gaddafi. So that's why they're there. And of course, it was during the overthrow of Gaddafi that that bomb attack took place. And the alleged bomber had in fact been fighting for the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group in Libya before he came back to do the bombing in Manchester, if the official story is correct. But of course, he'd been directed to go to Libya by MI6. And his father, who was still in Libya, said this is a fix-up, this is a stitch-up by MI6. But you didn't hear much about that in the mainstream media at all, did you?
I mean, there's basic stuff like the guy Salman Abedi, who's supposed to have done this, being reported to the anti-terror hotline. And MI5 didn't even bother to follow that up. I mean, what's the point of picking up the phone?
Well, the thing is that what happens is that they may know what's going to happen, and they basically let it happen. Because don't forget, that attack was very important in the election campaign, wasn't it? Corbyn was surging ahead, and of course, what the deep state think, well, if we can just have a nice bomb attack in a Labour voting city, that'll put Corbyn on the back foot. What's he going to say about that?
Okay, so this is a really perverse and utterly disgusting decision by the courts, because the Investigatory Powers Tribunal has claimed that the appropriate measures to prevent the incident infringed their human rights. That's what they were claiming at the Investigatory Powers Tribunal. But in this ruling last Friday, Lord Justice Singh and Mrs. Justice Farby said the cases could not proceed as they were brought too late. Now, the lawyers had told the families, and by the way, there's 300 people, including survivors and those bereaved by the 2017 attack. They were told, well, you're going to have to wait for all of the other judicial processes to finish before you actually sue the security services in the Investigatory Powers Tribunal. But funnily enough, even though all of those things, for example, including the inquiry, have now gone, been published, and they've then started their action, they're then told, oh, sorry, too late.
Well, it's Kafkaesque, isn't it, to use the phrase. The other thing that's been going on, actually, Tony, I don't know if you've been following it, is the so-called inquiry into the Skripal affair, where the Skripals themselves have been forbidden to testify, even though apparently they want to testify, and some guys turned up supposedly representing them, saying that they can't testify because they might be in danger if they did. And there's all sorts of stuff coming out which just contradicts the official narrative. And of course, they've set up, it should have been a coroner's inquest or something, but it's now an inquiry. You know, it's basically Mickey Mouse. You know, the deep state in this country has set up a whole kind of Mickey Mouse legal structure. And of course, you know, all of these things were in embryo anyway during the troubles in Northern Ireland.
So it took almost 6 years for the failings of MI5 to be revealed, confirmed when the inquiry chair published his Volume 3 findings in March 2023 last year, in which he said MI5 had missed significant opportunities to prevent the attack. This report concluded that within a six-year period, the security service corporate witnesses, who we're not even allowed to know their names, X and J, right, gave evidence on oath that had presented an inaccurate picture. So, in other words, they perjured themselves. The same inaccurate picture had been presented to Lord Anderson when he compiled his report in 2017. The law firm said, following these findings, their clients believed the information... IPT, whatever it is, Powers Tribunal, Investigatory Powers, that's right, Tribunal would find the route, provide the route to the formal vindication of their human rights. But it seems that these people really are above the law. They have been told there's nothing else by these particular lawyers that they can do now. But all these, you know what I'm reminded of? When we interviewed Graham Foulkes, whose son died in the 7/7 bombings, I think it was last year when this inquiry report came out, Martin, he said the most striking thing for him was exactly the same. Mistakes were made, mistakes with big inverted commas, by MI5. As had happened that killed his son in the 7/7 London bombing. So quite clearly, MI5 is not fit for purpose unless maybe it's performing some other role other than protecting the British public.
Well, that's got to be the suspicion, hasn't it? And, of course, they've passed these law, now I can't remember what it's actually called, that anybody in the police, military or intelligence services, if they're doing something in the course of their duty, they cannot be prosecuted or held to account. They're above the law. If such a law was passed to the Russian Duma to vote on, they would just laugh. That because of the history of the country, they would just say there is absolutely no way, Jose, that we're going to have the intelligence services not answerable to the law. That's just, I mean, obviously a lot of the time they do operate outside the law, but there's absolutely no reason to make that a rule.
I wonder what the Duma would make of passing a law to allow doctors to be paid to kill people. I mean, it'd be interesting to know what the Russians would make of that. I don't think there's ever going to be introduced into their parliament.
I don't know, Tony, but we don't find anything out about what the Russian parliament does.
Well, this seems
it's all irrelevant anyway, because we all know that Putin's a terrible dictator.
What I'm saying is it seems to be a policy of the Anglo-American Empire to do these things, like, for example, these things introduced in Canada to trial it out, and then once it's managed to smuggle through the law in Canada, they do the same here. Anyway, look, finally, £500 million, this is again, this time last week, defence cuts as ships, drones and helicopters have been scrapped. Does it matter? Do we really need these old drones? There's new drones coming along, and our ships and helicopters are these kind of old-fashioned devices that Britain doesn't need to defend itself anymore.
Well, I mean, the question is, we do whatever defence we need to define what it's for and what the purpose of it is. But what's happening now is we've lost the war in Ukraine, but we're escalating anyway. And apparently there's a big lobby in Britain for us to go it alone and support Zelensky, who is, of course, not elected now because there was supposed to be an election in May. He didn't have one. And, of course, the opinion polls in Ukraine itself show that nearly 60% of people now want a ceasefire and negotiations. But the British Army doesn't, for some reason. They're keen for them to fight on. And that's what the Operation Alchemy is all about, Project Alchemy is all about. And it's very, very sinister, all of it.
Okay, Martin, and we're going to finish this week with just a bit of a tribute to a chap called Peter Lynch, who I'd only just come across this story, but he died in prison. He was one of those people who was protesting. He wasn't violent. He was making comments about too much migration. He was put in prison and now apparently has committed suicide. So I thought we'd finish this week, since we've been talking about assisted dying, to hear what he had to say, what he was saying on his microphone, the chap that's no longer with us. After being incarcerated.
We did a vote in 2016, the democratic vote, it's not being upheld. Parliament's took it on to themselves. The corrupt MPs have took it on to themselves to deny our vote what we put them in power for. But now they're in power, they're stuck there defying what we put them in here for. And all these corrupt MPs now are saying they're getting picked on and abused, but why not? They actually went in there to do a job and they've gone and turned against other people, which is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, how do we go by our rights and bring our children up if the corrupt system all the way through police, judicial services, everything, it's all involved. Parliament, MPs, everything, they're all corrupt. We've got Prime Ministers corrupt. So how can we tell our children to bring them up straight and narrow when everybody above them is corrupt, but yet they're expecting the people to do as they're told by people that's not doing as they're told, but what they're putting here for. So I just can't see around it unless they come out Brexit. I don't even trust the ballot service anymore, because I don't trust them fixing it. Honestly, they've so corrupt their whole system. I don't even trust the balloting system.
So that's poor old Peter Lynch. Bless you, mate. And you've completely, absolutely right to bring up the issue of mass migration, whether it's legal or illegal. Of course, it's making an enormous difference to the country, and the people should be able to decide these things, that they're not being given that chance. Just before we finish, this week's poem from Patrizia is not unsurprisingly about assisted dying, most of the doctors I've spoken to say it's not assisted suicide. Call it what it is. And like I say, I'll put the link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the full speech by Danny Kruger and the previous one by the woman who was bringing the bill in. So it's called License to Kill. In COVID days, this evil spread. Behind closed doors, they killed folks dead. Did away with those they think too ill, too old, or on the brink of death. The killing fields, nail rife, nudge units spiel, cuts like a knife. A mercy death, new con, we hear. A pitch for death, not life, to steer. And normalise abhorrent acts, rope of death, take up the slack. Deals behind the scenes now grow, anyone of cost must go. The coffers empty, stolen funds, by hook or crook our lives outrun. Life is cheap to those who plan to rid the earth of woman, man, children too, who cost too much, this time 'tis true. Everywhere we turn now find madman of wealth with death-crazed mind. Thanks, Patrizia. And she puts a little note on the end here. She's turning into our reporter too, aren't you, Patrizia, the researcher. Euthanasia, however, would clearly count as a deliberate act of murder and a violation of the Sixth Commandment. It's intentional destruction of someone who is created in the image of God and therefore a deliberate act of rebellion against God. And just a little note, I'm hoping that the Richie Allen show, he's had a couple of months break, it will be back on Monday. So if you're itching for some good radio, just something to listen to, he should be around back beginning of next week. And so it's time to sign off from us now. Thanks to our guest Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Thanks also to local Bristol freelance journalist Joe Banks, as well as Dr. who's been part of Médecins Sans Frontières, actually out in Gaza at the beginning of all this genocide. That's Dr. Chris Hook, as well as sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page, but the best place to do that is on the Telegram channel, Tony Gosling Censored. And you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links and comment page at thisweekoneword.org.uk. So, we've been streaming live from the Eastone Studios in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us onto FM, AM, Longwave, or shortwave, please do. Any kind of rebroadcasting, let us know though, and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down. Well,
at you, I don't understand why you let the things you did get so out of hand. You'd have managed better if you'd had a plan. No, why'd you choose such a backward time in such a strange land? If you'd come today, you could have reached the whole nation. Israel in poor BC had no mass communication. Does it get me wrong? Does it get me wrong?
Yeah.